some people waiting.
Hey, Bill, did we leave the slides? Oh, there we go. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So just some ground rules for this morning. Okay. The screen sharing back. Yeah. Okay. So for the ground rules for the meeting today, so we're going to please honor the agenda. We are going to try to provide a balance of speaking time between the different participants in the call today. Please listen to understand and ask questions to clarify. We know that there's a lot of dense material, and we are definitely here to be able to present what the thoughts are, but also understand that there's a lot of meaty information here that needs to be clarified as well. To respect each other's viewpoints and values and interests, and to focus on topics at hand. So just general, I think all of you in this era of Zoom calls understand this, but just as a reminder, please stay on mute while you are not speaking. The background noise is really distracting. And then please, as Bill has put into the chat box, set your display names to your name and organization so we can easily identify who's speaking. For the questions today, we're going to be using the raise hand button to get into the queue, and our colleague Stephanie Summers will be managing that queue. And so it'll be easier for her to identify who's speaking if you have your names there. If you are joining by phone, press the *9 to raise your hand, and so we can see that. When it's your turn to speak, we will call on you. Stephanie will call on you and say your name. And when you do speak, can you please say your name and your affiliation before you speak? And if you can also use the chat feature to help troubleshoot any issues. Okay. So what we'll do now is since this is our first meeting, we wanted to do some introductions. First, we're going to do a round of introductions from the RAC, from the Rulemaking Advisory Committee. Stephanie is going to call on your name, and so if you can please introduce yourself, who you are, who you represent for this committee, and what your goals for this rulemaking are. And once we go through all of the RAC members, and we'll introduce the DEQ staff. Okay, Stephanie?
Hi, everybody. This is Stephanie Summers. I am just going to go through the list as it's listed on the roster. So, Greg Alderson.
Sure. I'm Greg Alderson. I work for Portland General Electric. Work on transportation electrification and other environmental-related policy issues for FCGE, and excited to find ways for the Clean Fuels program to do even more for transportation electrification.
Thank you, Greg. Isa De Cesaro. Is Eva with us? I was double muted. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Okay, great. Thanks. And thank you for a really good pronunciation of my name. So, Eva De Cesaro with Pacific Power, all things electric transportation at Pacific Power. Likewise, really excited to continue collaborating with the folks on this rulemaking and other stakeholders in order to support continued transportation electrification for all Oregonians.
Great, thanks, Eva. So now, Romaine.
Hey there, this is Danelle Romaine. How are you? Mike Fries and I are both on here. We're representing the Oregon People's Utility District Association, six electric utilities in Oregon, as well as the Oregon Fuels Association, a group of fuel retailers and distributors. Thank you.
Thanks, Danelle. Stu Green.
Morning, all. Stu Green. City of Ashland Electric. Glad to see everybody here. I guess my goals for this rulemaking are to help us make the best decisions we can to actually meet the CFP program goals and also try to keep this program effective, but at a manageable level of complexity.
Thank you, Steve. Victoria
Pekar, sorry if I'm mispronouncing your last name. Thanks, Stephanie. Good morning, everyone. Victoria Pekar with Climate Solutions, and I work on transportation electrification and transportation equity in my role as Oregon Transportation Policy Manager. The goal that I'm working towards in this rulemaking is to ensure that transportation electrification priorities are adapted to meet transportation equity goals for low income and communities of color.
Thank you, Victoria. Jana Gastelon?
I think Jana might be a little late. I got a text from her that says she had some making sure her kids got on her Zoom calls this morning for school.
Yeah. Okay, so let me move to the next person then. Annabelle Drayton.
Stephanie, hi everyone. My name is Annabelle Drayton. I'm a policy associate with the Northwest Energy Coalition, and I focus on transportation, electrification, and carbon policy. My goals for this rulemaking include, but limited to, increasing access to the benefits of the Clean Fuels Program for low-income residents and impacted communities in Oregon, as well as just increasing electricity as a transportation fuel overall.
Thank you, Annabelle. The next person that I have on here is Mike Getz.
Good morning. Hi, everyone. My name is Mike Getz. I'm the general counsel for the Oregon Citizens Utility Board. We're the residential ratepayer advocate of the large investor-owned utilities here in the state of Oregon. So hoping to bring, you know, some of the knowledge that I have about the electricity sector to this rulemaking, you know, to help meaningfully lower the carbon intensity of fuel mix and you know, construct some rules around the electricity portion of the Clean Fuels Program that are good. Kind of meaningfully drive the program forward and look forward to working with everybody.
Great. Thank you, Mike. John Thornton?
Yes, this is John Thornton. I'm with Clean Future. Clean Future's core business is working with fleets and fleet efficiency and transportation emission reduction. We look at the Clean Fuels Program as an important element to do that. Some of our goals in this is to, in the program, is to look at the rulemaking to ensure new vehicles and equipment types can participate in the program, and also the ability to match renewable electricity with some of those electric vehicle types.
Great. Thank you, John. Rhett Lawrence?
Hey, all. Rhett Lawrence, Pacific Northwest Policy Manager at SCORP. Yeah, I'm echoing comments from others. I think our goals would be to, you know, maximize the use of clean fuel credits to increase transportation electrification and do so in an equitable way. Thanks.
Thank you, David Green.
Yeah. Hi. Good morning, everybody. This is David Green. I'm the Air Quality and Energy Program Manager for the Port of Portland. So the port has been a very advocate and supporter of the Clean Fuel Program, as well as a participant. And we have made touch points on transportation in freight and passenger services. And, you know, so our interest is in expanding the transition to electrification and the pathways to get there for different and new types of equipment and vehicles.
Thank you, David. Evan Nyland?
Hey, good morning, everyone. Evan Nyland with ChargePoint. So with ChargePoint, the world's largest network operator of EV charging stations. For goals, leverage the Clean Fuels Program to advance transportation electrification in Oregon and further build out EV infrastructure.
Great.
Great. Thank you, Evan. Eric Carlin?
Hey, yeah. Eric Carlin with Green Office here. And similar to what I just heard, we're interested in increasing access to and participation options for electricity as a transportation fuel in the clean fuel program.
Great. Thank you, Eric. Tiffany Roberts? I'm looking to see if I don't see Tiffany on the call. So I'm going to move forward with the next person. Michael Graham?
Good morning. I'm Michael Graham. I represent the Columbia Atlantic Clean Cities Coalition as the Director of Policy and Communications. We work with public and private fleets across Oregon and Southern Washington in helping them adopt lower carbon alternative fuels. The Clean Fuels Program has been instrumental in many of our members participating in or reducing their emissions with alternative fuels. We're interested in increasing the value of credits, increasing the accessibility and the availability of credits for public and private fleets across the state.
Great, thank you, Michael. Thad Kowalski?
Hi, everybody. Thad Kowalski here with CASPA. The focus that I'm interested in within the discussion is the provider of both charging and electric vehicle manufacturer, kind of honing in on the ways that credit generation can and the revenue surrounding that can be focused in particular areas that, from our experience, would help accelerate adoption in Oregon. Thanks.
Thank you, Dad. Andrew Dick? Okay, I see Andrew.
I think he's still muted.
Yeah, I tried to have some time to mute. Are you there, Andrew?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Great. This is Andrew Dick, State Government Affairs and Public Policy Manager for Electrify America. As the other EVSPs have mentioned, this is an extremely important program for supporting the build-out of EV charging infrastructure in Oregon. So we're here to help build on the excellent work that the EQ has done to date and improve the attributes of this program moving forward.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. And I just want to go back. I think Jenna is here now. So did you want to introduce yourself as well, Jenna?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Jana Gastel with the Oregon Environmental Council. You see her pronouns. I am here to support kind of the success of the Clean Fuels Program, both in this rulemaking and then over the long haul. We're really excited about the opportunities to accelerate electrification in as many markets as possible and really like that. This sector is constantly evolving and there's new opportunities and looking for ways we can really accommodate the evolution and change in the electric sector. And then we really want to ensure equity is strongly included in this rulemaking and upholding the environmental integrity of the program along the way as well. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Jenna. All right. Is Tiffany here? I just want to give one more call out to her just in case.
I didn't see Tiffany pop in. I guess I was wondering if there's somebody else on the call that is representing Western States Petroleum Association today.
Good morning. This is Kelsey Wilson. I represent Western States Petroleum Association, and I'm on the call. I'm trying to get a hold of Tiffany to see if she is popping on or what her status is.
Okay. Thanks, Kelsey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is Mark Ventura from PIDIP 66, member of WESPA, Western State Petroleum Association. Unfortunately, I don't think Tiffany will be able to join today.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Okay, so I think that's for all of the RAC staff. I did want to do a round of introductions for the DQ staff that is on the call now. I'll start with myself. I think most of you know me. My name is Corianne Wendt, and I am the Oregon Clean Fuels Program Manager. Very excited to be kicking off this rulemaking. I will hand it over to Stephanie to introduce herself.
Hi, everybody. I'm Stephanie Summers. I work in the Clean Fuels Program, and I mostly handle the reporting. So you've probably most all heard from me at one time or another.
Bill, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Bill Peters. I've worked as an analyst in the Clean Fuels Program.
Okay, actually. Is Kiara on the call by any chance? I don't think I saw her name. I just wanted to mention that we do have a new team member for the Clean Fuels Program team. Her name is Kiara Winans, and she is a new fuels pathway specialist for us. So if any of you are working on pathways that need to get approved for the state, we have a dedicated person to do that now. I'd also like to pass it on now to Colin McConaughey, who's the manager of the Office of Greenhouse Gas Programs. Colin?
Yeah, thanks, Corey. Good morning, everybody. I'm Colin McConaughey. As Corey mentioned, I manage our Office of Greenhouse Gas Programs and Clean Fuels. The Clean Fuels Program is a signature program both of our state and certainly within our office. And I just want to thank everybody, all in particular our members of our advisory committee. Thank you in advance for all your time and commitment to this rulemaking. I think it's a really exciting one. I think it's clear that electricity is one of the most critical fuels to decarbonizing our transportation sector. And I think the Clean Fuels Program has done a great job to date. Been one of the most meaningful programs, I think, in our state for encouraging that transition to electricity. But I think it can do more. And I think this rulemaking is going to help this program incentivize electrification even further. I think that's going to be critically important for this program as it's scoped right now. We're entering the second half of the decade that the program is currently scoped for. And I think Corey has a slide a little later on showing that the ambition of the program in the second half of the decade really increases from the first half that we've experienced so far. So anything we can do in a rulemaking like this to make the program even better, to better incentivize clean fuels, and in this case, electricity in particular. Our governor and our legislature both separately made statements with ambitious electrification goals, and I think this program is really going to be one of the key mechanisms in Oregon for achieving those ambitious goals. So, again, thanks in advance, everyone. This is a really important and also very fast rulemaking. So I want to acknowledge the pace that we're going to be taking, and I think that pace really has already caused us to really ask for the advisory committee members' engagement to provide ideas and suggestions at a level that are really have thought through how something would be implemented a little bit more than sometimes we ask in our rulemakings because of how quickly we want this rulemaking to progress and how quickly we want it to take effect. So again, thanks in advance for all your ideas, and I appreciate particular folks taking time to think through how ideas can really be implemented in this program. So with that, Corey, I'll hand it right back to you. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Colin. I just wanted to remind everybody as well that we are recording this session. We're recording the audio. We're not recording all of the webinar. We will be posting the slide set as well as the audio onto our webpage when we get that file loaded. So just as a reminder. Okay, next slide. So we just want to provide background for why we're doing this rulemaking. As many of you know, Governor Brown back in March issued Executive Order 2004. Significant among in that executive order is the direction to EQ, to the Environmental Quality Commission and to the Department of Department of Environmental Quality to amend the Clean Fuels Program, both in the stringency and the period that it covers. So we are currently at to set in rules to achieve 10% reductions in the carbon intensity
from 2015 levels, where the 10% reductions out to 2025, and what the executive order directs us to do is to amend the program to achieve 20% reductions in 2030 and 25% in 2035. So those, as Colin alluded to, are very significant reductions. Just for those of you that like to see it out in a graph, what this shows is then where the currently adopted standards are and where the percentage reductions are. So again, beginning our program in the 2016 year for reductions, and we're in 2020, we're in the fifth year, we're at 2.5% reductions at this time. Actually, for all of you as well that are interested in the data, you'd be to note that the Q1 2020 data summary did get posted yesterday onto our website, and the first quarter shows that there are net credits over deficits as far as generation for the first quarter, so we're off to a good start for shifting from the 1.5% to the 2.5% reductions. So as the graph shows, 10% reductions out to 2025, and then this period of standards, what will be between 2025 and 2035, that will be subject to a future rulemaking. So that's not what this rulemaking is about. It's about the future. It will, and that will establish what the annual standards are between the 2025 period and 2035. For this particular rulemaking, it's a separate section in the executive order, and that it points to, it directs DEQ, again, EQC and DEQ, to advance methods of accelerating the generation and aggregation of clean fuel credits by utilities to advance the transportation electrification goals in Senate Bill 1044. Those are some very aggressive goals to electrify transportation. And as you've all undoubtedly have heard the news yesterday out of California Governor Newsom, some very, very aggressive goals to just to really transform the transportation sector to electrification, to zero emission vehicles. So that is the basis for this rulemaking. I know in this rulemaking it does speak specifically to the utilities, and the utilities play a very significant role here. But we understand that the electrification sector is very, very broad, lots of very involved stakeholders, and it's very much a program where we need the automakers, the charger providers, the utilities, all of the stakeholders, all the local governments and what have you, to actually participate in this. There is no silver bullet. And so we are very much open to looking at all of the different ways that the clean fuels program can help in achieving these TE goals. Okay. So the next slide, just to kind of set some context as far as timeline. The expansion of the clean fuels program is not just a matter of changing the requirements for the carbon intensity reductions out to 2035. There are a lot of different pieces that will inform how we set those standards. And these are a series of different, I think, major steps, major milestones in what will get us to that eventual rulemaking. It starts with a series of studies. I think many of you have participated in these kinds of things, illustrative compliance scenarios, to be able to kind of look at all of the different technology options and fuel options, and what could be the path forward to 25% reductions up to 2035. We do have ICF under contract to do that work, and we will begin that shortly. And so stay tuned for your notifications of that process. We will hold Zoom meetings to solicit stakeholder input for those as well. So that will kind of be going along parallel to this electricity rulemaking. And then the second study here is just to describe. So this is a contract, a piece of work that we're working on with UC Davis, the Institute of Transportation Studies, And in as much as the illustrative compliance scenarios can inform what the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions could be, what we're also interested in characterizing the benefits from a health and social perspective on what the Clean Fuels Program can provide to the state of Oregon as well. So not just life cycle emissions, tailpipe emissions. We're looking at criteria pollutants and toxic pollutants as well as the greenhouse gases. So very excited to be able to better characterize the benefits of this program. Then in the next, so this is the green rows are the electricity rulemakings. We are scoped to go between now and approximately, I think it's the week before Thanksgiving as far as staff meetings. And scheduled right now to be at the EQC, I'm going to say March, but we go every other month with the EQC meetings, so March or May, as far as adoption of these rules. The next two rows in the purple describe a process that is actually written in statute. House Bill 2017 requires the agency to produce for the legislature a formal program review. And there's a list of criteria that we're supposed to address, progress towards our goals and all the benefits and cost impacts and availability largely on fuels and how the future beyond 2025 was supposed to look at. And so, again, so since we're in this very kind of enhanced stakeholder involvement with all of you all, that I decided to put that into this time schedule as well. Which will then lead into the actual rulemaking to expand the program to the 25% by 2035. We're looking at the second half of 2021 going through the first half of 2022 with rulemaking advisory committees and stakeholder involvement currently scoped to go to the commission mid-2022. Definitely want to get it more in the middle of the year with effective dates for 2023, but knowing that, it does take time to do implementation work after the rules are adopted and to give us some time to get ready for January of 2023. So, Okay. So the meetings for this rulemaking are today, they are like both Colin and Bill alluded to earlier, very quick. They're basically at 2 week intervals starting today and then October. The next three are what I have described as breakout meetings, so smaller chunks of as far as the topics that we're going to talk about, and so not everything. And so we'll have these breakout meetings in October 8th and 22nd, November 5th, and then everybody bring together the coming back as a one big graph. Obviously, everybody is open to participate in any of the conversations, but the last meeting will kind of wrap up all of the topics, as well as have our fiscal and economic analysis discussion where we describe what the fiscal impacts of the proposed rules are. And that was scheduled for November 19th. After that, we will, what the next step there is for the notice of proposed rulemaking, which is the start of our formal public comment period, and that's slated to begin mid-December. The public hearing in mid-January, and then in the comment period soon after that public hearing, and then wrap up all of those comments, respond to comments, and take it to the EQC, like I said, in March or May of 2021. So very quick timeline. Okay. So to get to this meeting, so what the goal for today's meeting is primarily to provide a forum to hear your ideas about what potential changes to the electricity provisions of the Clean Fuels Program are. We'd like to introduce some initial concepts that have been raised in the discussion paper and provide some of the agency's initial thoughts on what those proposals are. We want to be able to respond to any stakeholder questions that you have. So please offer all of your comments and questions throughout today's discussion. We also want to highlight areas where the agency is soliciting specific feedback, especially where we have considered that there might be multiple options that are possible, as well as to be able to really vet what the pros and cons of each of these different options are. We know that there, in a lot of cases, there isn't a clear-cut path forward, and so we very much want to hear what those pros and cons are. And we also do, because of the very fast, quick timeline for this rulemaking, we want to create a path forward to the targeted discussions in the next three breakout meetings. The vision here is that whatever we're, when we're done with the conversations today, you know, it's pretty quick turnaround for us to be kind of come back with the next level of discussion papers, the next level of detail, you know, the next level of even potentially draft language for these breakout meetings. And we want to be able to capture as much of the stakeholder input from today as possible. And also recognize the fact that in the breakout meetings, there will be very, very focused, detailed discussions about that. But really looking towards this November 19th date to be able to kind of wrap everything up. It's very important to kind of make sure that all of these concepts are moving forward. Or I guess I would say, and vice versa, you know, if something really doesn't make sense and people really don't like it, for us to know that sooner or later, sooner than later also helps us quite a bit. Okay. So just to for some guiding principles of reminders for the Clean Fuels Program, as far as maintaining the integrity of the Clean Fuels Program, these are the things that we strive to achieve. We really want to achieve real and quantifiable greenhouse gas reductions first and foremost. We know that the Clean Fuels Program, you know, is designed to be technology and fuel neutral, and we want to remain as true to that as possible. We want to use the best available science, and we will be asking you today through the proposals often for data and science to be able to inform how we move forward with these proposals. And we know increasingly important for the Clean Fuels Program is to provide incentives for technology development, commercialization, and deployment that will produce permanent paths through to decarbonizing the transportation sector. We know that that is, it plays an increasingly important role in the state of Oregon. The money and the value of the credits from the program are significant to projects, and we would like to do more of that. Okay. So I am going to pause there. Does anybody have any quick, any kind of general questions as far as process that they want to cover? I know there are several questions about posting the slides and then the audio. Yes, they will be put onto the website. Does anybody have any questions general in nature right now? No? Okay. So at this time, then, I'm
going to...
Oh.
This is Mark Ventura from Pitted 66. Just a general question on the process. So once this pre-rulemaking is complete and you start the official rulemaking, and the official rulemaking is complete, then you submit the package essentially to the EQC. On the process, is there any chance for public comments in front of the EQC? Or it's essentially the EQC is just a discussion between the EQ and EQC, and EQC decide to adopt or not adopt.
Right. So the opportunity for comments from stakeholders comes in that notice of proposed rulemaking time period. And so the written comments throughout that period is the mechanism to do that. We will also have an opportunity for public comment if you want to have oral testimony, but that is not attended by the EQC members. That is hosted by the agency. So once that comment period is done, then there isn't any other opportunity for comment in front of the EQC.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Corey and Scott Karofsky with Tesla. I have a question about the guiding principles. And, you know, there's included in here is the best use of available science. But I'm curious if the department had considered essentially the accuracy of the data, not necessarily related to science, but related to credit generation itself, and whether there was a variety of mechanisms that could be used in including estimation as it's been done, but also via vehicle telematics and reporting requirements.
Yes, absolutely. I think, science we use pretty loose here. You know, we know that the more and more of these electric vehicles that get deployed, we have better on-the-ground data. We do have some modeling since, you know, the technology is so new. Telematics is definitely an interesting, a place of interest for us, as well as data that we can get from smart charging technologies broader than the automakers from the charger EVSEs as well. So,
great.
Yeah.
Thank you for the clarification on that. Science.
Yep. Okay, so now what I'll be doing is I'll be turning over the mic to Bill. Bill will be walking through the discussion paper with the following slides. And just for kind of your orientation, whenever we get to a slide generally that says discussed at the top of it on the green ribbon, that is where we've kind of built in natural pauses to the conversation, so it's not just still talking for the whole time. But, you know, we'll lace out some initial thoughts and descriptions of the things that we're going to be presenting here, and then we'll open it up to key questions or things that we are seeking input from on those specific topics. Okay?
Thanks. And just as a quick reminder, I went back to the slide. So we are going to ask that you use the raise your hand feature if you're on the webinar for us to call on people in an orderly manner. We also have the chat function available. If you have clarifying questions on a slide, if I haven't been clear about a specific point, feel free to post those there, and I'll try and get to them when we get to one of those places where you can pause or as I'm going through the slides. But again, Stephanie will be calling on folks when we get to the discussion slides, so please use the raise your hand function, as that's what we'll be using to go through. For those of you who are on the phone and would like to participate, if you, in order to raise your hand using Zoom, just need to press *9. And we'll try and remember to say that again at some point, especially after the break. So with that, I'm going to try and move relatively quickly through the slides because we do have a lot of material to cover, as Corey mentioned earlier. The first slide is, or the first section here is going to be on general provisions. So talking about the concept of incremental crediting. Increasing the frequency of crediting for electric vehicle charging, and then also a discussion around creating provisions that would direct revenues from credit sales related to electricity crediting. So the first topic here is one that California pioneered in their 2018 rulemaking for the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, and that's to create incremental credits for residential electric vehicle charging. What this means is that so base credits are what the Clean Fuel Program currently issues to utilities based on the electric vehicles in their service territory that are charging at home. We have, as was alluded to in Bob's comments, an estimation methodology in place now based on data sets we have that show what, on average, electric vehicles charge on a daily basis at home. And we use that to estimate how much charging is occurring in utility service territories over the course of the year, and then issue those credits out. Those credits are based on the utility's carbon intensity or the statewide NICS carbon intensity. What the incremental crediting concept here is for additional actions that further lower the carbon intensity of electricity for those vehicles, that, and we'll get into this in a lot more detail later in the day, would be, you know, increased access to renewable electricity or smart charging technologies that shift the time of day when electric vehicles are charging to the times when the grid is less carbon intense. So, you know, for example, if, you know, that would be technology that tells the car, you know, don't charge now because, you know, all the coal plants are running, but charge later tonight when it'll be mostly hydro and wind making up the bulk of the generation on the system. We'll be discussing this in more detail later. We're just briefly raising the concept now because it'll help ground some of the discussions we have later today. The next topic that we brought up in the general provisions section of the white paper is that we currently issue those residential credits once per year. We get, at the end of the year, we get data from Oregon's DMV that lets us figure out, okay, how many electric vehicles do we have, where are they in the state, and then we use that data to end a set of maps of utility service territories that we've received and gathered over the years and had some updates to figure out which utilities those electric vehicles are being served by. As we get more electric vehicles in state purchased and being used by Oregonians, we think it makes sense to move from that once a year model to something more frequent. We think that that would, you know, one, you know, we're currently waiting until the end of the year to let everybody know how many credits are being issued for residential EV charging, and as that becomes a more significant fraction of the credits in the market, we think having those calculated more frequently, having that information be available is important. It can also, you know, help make sure the utilities are getting credits in a more timely manner, and that can affect, you know, how many credits they have in a given year, and what revenue they can then put towards transportation electrification programs. So the next slide. So we'll talk about this a little bit later as we discuss incremental crediting, but among the changes that, so some of the proposals we have could include allowing parties other than the utilities or the backstop aggregator, and just as a reminder to those who are not familiar with our program, residential EV credits are generated either by the utility who has opted into the Clean Fuels program, or we have a backstop that is selected for an RFP process, it's currently for, that gets those credits and then, you know, through an agreement with the agency, you know, monetizes those credits and puts the value of those credits towards transportation electrification projects and programs in the utility service territories that have not opted into the program and on a statewide basis. So as we consider some incremental crediting options that could, that may allow parties other than utilities of the backstop aggregator to generate credits, and as the value of those credits becomes more significant over time, we're considering if it makes sense to add requirements for how credit revenues are spent by utilities based on those phase and incremental credits from you know, residential EV owners in the state. In the paper, we you know, give an example of what California has done here. They've created a list of possible, you know, projects and programs along with some you know, requirements around spending revenue in, you know, affected communities and low-income communities. So, you know, this is something that we're considering, and I think we have a lot of questions around, and we want to just kind of get a sense of, you know, what people are thinking here and, you know, how best we can direct that revenue that to investor-owned utilities that have opted into the program, Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp, through the, have some principles and a process and a public comment process basically laid out by the Public Utility Commission in their docket UM 1826 that does a decent amount of this work. And, you know, we're interested if we should expand that concept further and just have you know, the guiding principles live in the CUES rules so that they can also be used by other entities. So with that, I'm going to ask people to start raising your hands if you have comments here. I'm going to quickly go, before I have to turn this over to Stephanie, I think I saw a couple clarifying questions in the chat that I'm going to go to. And then we have, you know, the white paper itself asks a number of questions, and then we've posted some of them here. So please raise your hand if you want to discuss them. And I'll quickly go through two questions that we got in the chat box. So the first one from Jennifer Jolly, what does this concept, incremental credits, mean for COUs that get power from BPA? So most of the if not all of the COUs at this point that have opted into the clean fuels program have opted in for utility-specific carbon intensity scores. And because they get the majority of their power or all their power from BPA, depending on if they're a full requirements customer or not, their carbon intensity scores are quite low. We didn't include a graph of that in the slides, but generally they're around 4 to 5 grams per megajoule versus a statewide mix, which is at 107 grams per megajoule. So they're very low carbon electricity because the vast majority of their electricity is from the hydro power system run by the Federal Bonneville Power Administration. Incremental credits would be giving credits based on the differential between utilities, carbon intensity for those territories in our initial thinking here, and, you know, zero carbon if it's, you know, pure renewable source like solar or wind or one of the others. We'll talk about that later. So there would be a relatively smaller benefit for those utilities just because the carbon intensity of electricity is already so low. You know, I think that we'll continue to discuss this and we want to hear thoughts about this, but, you know, hopefully that answers the question. And then the other question we have here let's just go and start going through the list. Stephanie, if you're ready, do you want to start calling on people and unmuting them?
Yeah, sure. The first one we have is a phone number, so I don't have their name, but I'm going to ask them to unmute now. Go ahead, 510,
et cetera.
What?
Yeah. This is the 4405. It's Mark Ventura, 3060. Just a question maybe from the prior slide was on the recording or the adjustment of the EV credits that, you know, currently are done on an annual basis when you're suggesting to go on a twice a year. I would think maybe to be consistent with the quarterly data report, you know, why don't you do it on a quarterly basis? I mean, it's not a huge, impact anyway to the credit bank. It's going to be the same, but if you're going to do the frequency adjustment, increase the frequency adjustment, you know, suggestion is to do it on a quarterly basis. That's all I had.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think what we were initially proposing semi-annual just because of the timing of when we get data from DMV. I think we've seen it on a more frequent basis. We work with our partners in Oregon State government and a number of them on the call here to make sure that we're getting that data. I think we were just trying to balance, you know, how frequently to issue credits against how often we would be getting good updated data set from our partners at DMV. Stephanie, do you want to call the next person?
Sorry, I was unmuting myself. The next person who has their hand up is Jason Hooper.
Yeah, hi, can you, everyone hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Great, thank you. I just wanted to comment on the questions posed on directing revenue. Just wanted to clarify, in the original rulemakings for the Clean Fuels Program, I think there was no direction given related to consumer-owned utilities that become aggregators for residential credits, and that was on the basis that, like the PUC, consumer-owned utilities have their own governing boards. I think the consumer-owned utilities are being great stewards of the revenues derived and investing them prudently in their areas to reduce emissions in the transportation sector and to deploy electrification. But I can understand a trust but verify approach to the program. So I think it makes sense that there would be some directive, policy directive given to that the use of those funds is to electrify the transportation system. And I can understand interest in some reporting requirements, a report from an aggregator. But I guess I would say I think some kind of middle ground could be a good incremental step for the program. It would be disappointing if we inadvertently stifle, you know, innovation and creativity, as well as the ability to adapt the use of those programs to specific local electricity mixes, as well as local transportation circumstances. I'll just share that in eWeb's case, we're working on an electrification study in partnership with the City of Eugene as part of their Community Climate Action Program. And it's very likely that the use of clean fuel program proceeds could be an important part of the City of Eugene's community action plan for reducing emissions in Eugene. And, you know, I think the current construct, we're able to be very strategic in using clean fuel program proceeds to the specific circumstances in Eugene and our local community climate action plan. So, I think some middle ground would be advisable, and I would hold off from doing something that could be overly prescriptive.
Yeah, thanks for those comments, Jason. I definitely hear that. I think one of the things that we're trying to figure out too is that, how broad and how narrow some of these lanes could be defined. Definitely with any kind of entity that already has some parameters in place, as much as we can align with what those are, I think is something that we're striving for too. I think as discussed in the paper, there's the utility investment, but there's also, as other utilities have generating credits in this space as well. I think that's kind of what kind of like spurred our thoughts about how to kind of like set some of these sideboards. So I just as a general comment for the some of the questions that we see in the chat, if we have questions that are just not on topic right now, please know that we are looking at them. And we will respond to them when we get to those topic discussions. So we're not forgetting about you, but there'll be other opportunities in the conversation today to respond to those more in context. Okay, Steph, next.
The next person with a question is Mike Getz.
Unmute myself here. Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to give a brief comment on the issue of directing revenues here. You know, as a stakeholder that's been involved in the investor-owned utility space and, in a few of the clean fuels proceedings where we've kind of worked with the utilities on, directing clean fuels credits towards programs that are, not only furthering the clean fuels program, but also delivering benefits to local communities and to residential customers who are the primary kind of generators of charging credits for those utilities. I think that we see that type of oversight is effective, and I think that we would be supportive of the DEQ taking a role in at least providing some parameters on how those types of credits should be spent in the COU space or in other spaces that aren't regulated. I think the points about being overly prescriptive are well taken, and I think that we need to be wary of, having a little bit kind of too much overreach or regulation. But I think, generally speaking, the kind of buckets that were put in the discussion document, from the experience down in California, I think are good. And I think,
we want to make sure that we're structuring this program in a way that's furthering the goals of the clean fuels program and actually lowering the carbon intensity of the fuel mix in the state. And I think having at least some level of oversight is an important step to making sure that, we get to that place. What exactly that looks like, I think that we're pretty flexible. I think on the IOU space, I think we like where that's at, and we like having the PUC, have the oversight that it does. And we do think that a certain level of oversight to other generators would be beneficial as well.
Great, thank you. Becky, you want to call the next person?
Yeah, actually, Andrew, I think, had the next question commented in the chat, so I'm going to try and unmute them. Andrew? Okay. I'm not sure if they're able to unmute or not.
Sorry, can you folks hear me?
There we go, yeah.
Thanks. Sorry, we're not allowed to install Zoom, so I'm having a little trouble with the interface here. So I just wanted to comment in the paper, it mentions that EBSD could be allowed to generate incremental credits in the future and conform to allowable uses for expenditures. I don't know if that would include lowering carbon intensity through the RECs and book and claim accounting potential paths that could be added. But I note that the discussion paper says that the permissible uses could be broad and could include paying off costs associated with generating the credits in the first place. We're strongly supportive of that, particularly in the early stages of DC fast charging deployment, and particularly very high power DC fast charging deployment. We face significant operating costs for our chargers. And so likely a very useful way to use those revenues would be to reinvest them in the system and ensure that our operating costs are covered to the extent that we can build additional infrastructure in the state. So we're supportive of that consideration from DEQ and would certainly want any provision to be broad enough to include covering ongoing operational costs of infrastructure.
Yes, thanks, Andrew. And actually, I'll remind everyone, as Jessica brought in the chat, to say your organization and your name when you get started. So that was Andrew Dick from Electrify America. I think that our goal is for these provisions, if we go forward with them and if they apply to charging equipment, for those who are not familiar with EVSD as a term, it's just the folks who are operating charging networks and electric car chargers. That, we wouldn't do anything in there that wouldn't allow you to, pay off your cost of installing and operating that charging equipment and making sure that it remains available to, the electric car drivers in the state.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. And so I think maybe we'll wrap this this topic up right now. And I did want to remind folks, too, as far as why it's important to raise your hand. We are, as far as calling on people, we are prioritizing RAC members and RAC members' comments and questions. And then if we know we have a lot of a lot of material to cover, so we are keeping track of the clock. And so, like I said, if you put something in the chat, we will definitely be following up at some point if you're not a RAC member. But please feel free to leave it there. As time permits, we will be trying to get as broad of comments and questions throughout the discussion, but we do have to manage the agenda a little bit. So why don't we move to the next topic, Bill?
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, so the next one is on encouraging new types of electric vehicles. So I'm going to start off with a general explanation of energy economy ratios. So there are two key components for electric vehicles or any alternative fuel vehicle in terms of how we calculate the carbon reductions that we're attributing to the use of that fuel in the world. The first is obviously the carbon intensity of fuel, so the carbon intensity of electricity in this case, and the second is the energy economy ratio. Those ratios are how we adjust our credit calculations to account for the higher efficiency engines in alternative fuel vehicles. For example, a full battery electric passenger vehicle, light duty, those engines are 2.4 times more efficient than generally what we see on the gasoline side on a per energy unit basis. So we set that EER at 3.4. What that does in the context of I made the decision not to put equations in the slides because they're a bit dense, but what that's used is both to adjust the delivered carbon intensity of the fuel, so electricity in this case is divided by 3.4, and we also award electric vehicles a displacement credit. So we're making sure that we accurately award the more efficient engines for the fact that they're using less energy on a per mile basis than a gasoline engine. So we equalize and award a displacement credit to the electric vehicles because, you know, you're only using about a third as much energy as a gasoline motor. Table 7 of our regulations for all of our energy economy ratios currently live. We have EERs for a variety of vehicles and fuels, from transit buses to forklifts to streetcars. And we also have some general categorical energy economy ratios for light and heavy duty. We also have those for some of the other alternative fuels like hydrogen and CNG and compressed natural gas and liquefied natural gas. So as we had in the paper, our initial thought for expanding what can generate credits in the program for this rulemaking would be to add two energy economy ratios that California's low carbon fuel standards adopted that we haven't yet. As Corey mentioned, this is one of the areas where we are asking for data. We use, the best studies we can find to determine, on a duty cycle basis, this internal combustion engine motor has this fuel economy versus the fuel economy of the electric motor. We think that the California rulemaking has some good studies included with it that we can rely on in this rulemaking. So we're proposing to move forward with both electric cargo handling equipment and electric ocean-going vessel equipment. The first one is, cargo handling that's larger than forklifts, basically, and is used at ports and elsewhere. And the electric ocean-going vessel is for shore power. So that's where ports and harbors basically have plugs and wires so that the ships, when they're in ports, don't need to run their engines, and they can instead get electricity from the grid, so they don't need to run their motors while they're at berth and continue burning diesel or a bunker fuel, depending on what they're running. So we think that, that both gets some air quality benefits because we're moving away from, the combustion that's relatively stationary in those locations, and also, incentivizes, the ports and the vessel owners to, use electricity. In both of these cases, we would propose that the owner of the charging equipment be eligible to generate the credits. More broadly, so the only way we currently have available to add new energy economy ratios is through a rulemaking such as this one. As electrification has spread to new vehicle types, there has been an increase in requests to us to add new EERs look at this very specific electric vehicle, and it doesn't have a duty cycle that quite fits the more general EER, so let's establish a specific one for that. Waiting for the next rulemaking would basically delay the ability of those vehicles to potentially generate credits in the first place, as on the EERs that we currently have adopted can apply to them. Or it doesn't accurately characterize what their energy economy ratio is, so any credits that are awarded to them might not be, they might not get as many credits as they think they should get because they think that, their efficiency is higher than the energy economy ratio that applies to them currently. So in the rulemaking process, we tend to look at these studies, for these electric vehicles. We've done that in the past, and had a fairly detailed discussion in our, 2017 rulemaking around the energy economy ratios we're setting for light rail, streetcar, and the aerial tram, and how we did methodology for that. It's important for us to develop standards to establish whether adequate data exists to support the adoption of an EER, and also methodologies to ensure the comparison is accurate. And what we're meaning there is that as we see newer and newer forms of electric mobility, Some of those are not easy apples to apples comparisons. If I have a gasoline car and an electric car, I can drive them at the same speeds on the same highways for the same number of miles and figure out the energy conservation part. If we have other electric mobility options, like some of the things that have been raised to us are like electric scooters, other electric micro-mobility, figuring out how to accurately create an energy economy ratio for that is more difficult because, it's not just a one-to-one replacement. It's, it might be replacing a mix of, light-duty vehicle trips, transit trips, and others. So figuring out a repeatable, justifiable methodology for those kind of applications is something that will be important. So in order to be more efficient in adding new ERs, we're considering two basic options. One would be following a provision that California has currently in its rules, where they will, an applicant will apply for an adjusted carbon in, intensity for electricity based on the EER data that they're giving to the Air Resources Board down in California. And so in that case, they come, they say, our EER is this. So we think the carbon intensity of electricity should be adjusted like based on the data we have. And then they're issued a fuel pathway code that is specific to that applicant. And then the second option that we're considering is creating a provision that would allow for the administrative approval of new EERs outside of the rulemaking. So instead of issuing a carbon intensity of electricity that's adjusted to that vehicle, similarly to what we did in our last rulemaking to allow us to adopt temporary fuel pathway codes or substitute fuel pathway codes outside of the rulemaking, we would have some administrative process with a public comment period where we would get an application in from whoever it has these electric vehicles and would like to have an EER for them. We would review that as DQ, and then we would decide if we think that it makes sense, if we think the data is there, and then put that out for public comment so that other people who are interested, stakeholders, the public can comment on. So we're going to have some discussion on the next two slides, and I'm just going to pose these two general questions here. Just keep them in mind as I go forward. As we consider these provisions, two of the key questions for us are, if we move forward with this, should it be reserved for cases where none of the existing ERs could apply? So if we have a generic ER for light-duty electric vehicles and whatever the new application coming in is some form of light-duty electric vehicle, and can use that ER, should we, consider the application to say, no, use light-duty ER, and then we'll consider you in the next rulemaking? Or should we allow there to be some, splitting of that category and more specific EERs being issued. So that's one question we have and one consideration that we're weighing in our minds as we think about this provision. And also, are there cases where we really should be reserving adopting an EER for a formal rulemaking? And if we do have some threshold where we say, okay, we're allowing these types of applications to get an EER administratively and these types to pathway for rulemaking, how do we decide, what's over the line? How do we weigh the scales there? So first off, we're going to have some discussion around that first option, which is what's in California now, where it's a Tier 2 fuel pathway application process to, for that EER-adjusted carbon intensity. So the so California has some guidance. I think we've linked to that in the paper. And as we're considering this provision, I think the Oregon-specific considerations that we're thinking about is, what the resources would be for us to look at this. And then a difference between our rules and California's rules is that because we allow utilities to get their own carbon intensities, we have a lot more grid carbon intensities than California does. They have their statewide mix. And then they have the carbon intensities being claimed in their incremental crediting provisions or through booking claim of RECs. We have over 15 utility-specific mixes at this point. I can't remember the number off the top of my head. So as we consider this, and because, the fun thing about electric vehicles is that by definition they move around, you know, if we have a EER adjusted CI, that would mean adjusting the CI of all of the electricity mixes that we have in the program. So do we want to do that and have basically, you know, 15 different fuel pathway codes for each of these applications? That's another thing that we're considering as we go through this. So I'm going to pause for a second, let people raise their hands or press star 9 if you're on the phone, and I'll let Stephanie call on people. I'm going to, if I don't see any hands get raised in the next moment, I'll probably move on. There is one question in the chat on this, from David Breen of the Port of Portland. I suggest adding electric ground support equipment. So David, I think what we're considering there is if, so this is airport ground support equipment. You're free to unmute yourself and respond to my response here while we're in this phase. I think what we're considering is if the electric cargo handling EER that we're proposing to adopt from California could cover that equipment, or if it would fit more generally within like the forklift category.
So if the EER is adopted in through like the Tier 2 or other process in California, what might that mean for Oregon's adoption? Would that help streamline that, or still have to go through the full gamut of review?
So if there, so to step back a little bit, generally we have a provision in our rules on the fuel pathway code side that if you have an approved fuel pathway code in California, that we will, you know, have a streamlined application process for you to submit everything that you submit to California to us. We'll review that. We'll make sure, make any adjustments we need to for Oregon. And then if everything is up to snuff, we'll approve that, we'll recertify that fuel pathway code. We've had some discussions with applicants that are looking at this process in California and asking if they could take, use that same route through our rules to get an electricity adjusted CI. We haven't made any final decisions there. I think that's definitely a possibility. If somebody has gone through the, Air Resources Board review and they're issuing that electricity adjusted CI, that we could follow that process and give them streamlined review, because we know that our regulators down at the Air Resources, our sister regulators down at the Air Resources Board have, you know, kicked the tires on that application, for lack of a better term. So that's definitely a possibility.
And then maybe a follow-up question too, just understanding, you know, put into play, let's say a fleet of cargo handling equipment, mm-hmm. you know, all different, a number of different types of or pieces of equipment, each having different EERs. Does that mean in charging, they'll have to track their individual charging by piece of equipment because they've got different EERs?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the main considerations that we have when we're looking at this provision. So there's a balancing between, you know, having the general category of EER that just all cargo handling equipment has this one number. And, you know, we, if we have studies that show like, you know, this tug versus this tug have different EERs, we average those out for those general categories versus establishing, you know, I mean, if we go all the way to the other side, right, we would say, okay, this piece of equipment from General Electric gets this EER, this piece of equipment from Caterpillar gets this EER, and we, you know, go down to like the model years and vehicle types and have different EERs for all of those, and then make you guys report on each individual vehicle's charging separately. So there's an administrative burden there for you and for us as we're reviewing the reporting. So one of the balances we have with EER is between the, you know, more general broad categories and those very specific categories is, you know, does it make sense? Are the EERs actually that different? Are we talking about 3.4 versus 3.5 versus 3.3? Or, you know, is there a big enough difference there in that category that we should have multiple EERs and have them very specific? You know, I think that's one of the considerations we have. And that's partly why, you know, one of the questions on the prior slide was, you know, should we allow splitting of existing EER categories, or should we, you know, just have it be for new types of applications that really don't fit in those existing categories.
So, okay, that's helpful. Thank you. And it's just a general comment on that. The more splitting that happens, I can see that put into play, it could get really complex and difficult potentially, and maybe even an impediment to adoption of the vehicles, particularly where you may have different ownership across a fleet, like airport ground support equipment, which is owned by different airlines, and you have to think about how you would collect that data. Mm-hmm. So just throw that out there. The higher level, the easier, not only put into play, but in application, I think it's going to be really important. I mean, in applying for the EER.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I think we're always, as we move forward with these provisions, looking at, how they would work theoretically and then how they would work in practice and what makes sense for you guys, for the folks who are reporting to us, as well as, the workload for staff.
And actually just to speak directly to your question, David, if we do have EERs and we want to take advantage of them, then yes, you do have to report per EER. So that complicates it on your end as well. So.
Thank you for the clarification.
And I'll just briefly repeat something that Jane brought, answered in the chat, which is that if you're looking for where the raise hand button is, sorry, I didn't cover this earlier, just open up the participants list and it should be in the bottom of that box. Stephanie, do you want to call the next person?
Yeah, the next person that we have a question is Greg Alderson.
Yeah, thank you, Greg Alderson with PG. Bill, this is just a fully understanding kind of question. As I understand it, the CI, relates to the carbon intensity of electricity, while the EER is about the efficiency of the engine. Can you just help clarify for me what the EER, what the need to adjust EER is related to the electricity carbon content would be?
Yeah, so this is for electric vehicles that don't have an EER currently in our rules. So they don't have an energy economy ratio that they can use. So as I discussed earlier, the EER is used basically the carbon intensity of electricity divided by the EER in order to get at what the actual efficiency is of that engine. It's basically our way of converting, the fuel carbon intensity into more of a carbon intensity per mile figure in our credit calculation. So in this version of it, because we don't have an energy economy ratio for this new vehicle type, we would be just doing that adjustment up front by, issuing a fuel pathway code specific to those types of vehicles that already does that adjustment for the carbon intensity of electricity.
Did that answer your question, Greg?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. The next person that we have a question from is John Thornton.
Yeah, this is John Thornton, Clean Future. So I just want to put a comment. I am supportive of DQ having the administrative ability to put in new ERs outside the rulemaking cycle. With respect to the Tier 2 ER adjusted pathways, we would encourage that opportunity. I am not encouraging that we necessarily have a large, big, diversification of a bunch of ports, a bunch of categories, so maybe more at the vehicle level and not at the OEM or model level, that there is a need for a little more diversity and particularly some of these new vehicle or equipment types are becoming commercially available.
Thank you. Stephanie, you want to call the next person?
Yeah, the next person we have a question from is Michael Graham.
Thank you. Michael Graham with Columbia Willamette Clean Cities Coalition. I think that it's really awesome to allow new EERs in the program, and I also like the idea of having a mechanism to allow new EERs to be developed and admitted into the program, or at least assessed, in between rulemaking. And a case in point here is that we're seeing all kinds of new electric heavy-duty vehicles and equipment that are much more efficient than their diesel counterparts, so I strongly suggest that we have that kind of mechanism to allow new types of electric vehicles or equipment.
equipment to be admitted with updated EERs in between rulemakings.
All right, thank you. Stephanie will call the next person. And while we're doing that and they're giving their comment, I'm just going to move to the next slide so people can save a question for here.
Sure. So the next person is Jana.
Hi, this is Jana from Oregon Environmental Council. We also support doing this outside of the formal rulemaking process. The one question I do have is if we, I think trying to make it as administratively streamlined as possible would be great. The one question we have is if we ever think there's a case where there could be a really broad range within a category, just with different model types, just as things evolve, and if there may need at some point to be some more kind of model-specific EERs just because of the way technology is developing. But that's sort of maybe more a question. I don't know if John Thornton or anyone else has insights on that. But that would be, in general, I think having a whole class category is easier, but just wanted to raise that question.
Yeah, and that's a good consideration to have, and I'll let John step in if he'd like to. I mean, I think that we already see that in some different categories. You know, for example, just very quickly, you know, EPA has the fueleconomy.gov site that includes electric vehicles and what the fuel economy of electric vehicles is in terms of miles per kilowatt hour. And we do see some variation there. So, you know, I think that's, you know, one of the considerations we have to look at these. And I think just quickly to go over the slide and then take any last questions, then we'll take a quick break. So for the option where we're just directly administratively approving ERs, I think a lot of the application requirements would be similar for both this option and the ER adjusted carbon intensity. It really would just be adding a new energy economy ratio, having that out for, you know, public comment, which we would likely do also with the ER adjusted carbon intensities. And, you know, just adding it into the rule, into the online systems. And then probably next time we have the rulemaking, we would go in and, you know, pull those into the actual rule table rather than just having them posted elsewhere. You know, I think the, you know, questions that we have, and these are all things that people should, you know, they'll have an opportunity for written comments, and that these are all things that we're interested in getting written comments on, you know, is, you know, what the thresholds are here, what should we do if we find that, you know, an existing ER is inaccurate or isn't inaccurate as applied to a new vehicle type. You know, if there is a small improvement over an existing category and allow subcategorization, you know, should there be a threshold there? And also just, you know, what level and duration of public comment do people think is necessary for, you know, this kind of administrative approval process? You know, we have very prescribed timelines and minimum timelines in Oregon's Administrative Procedures Act rulemaking, and we want to make sure that, you know, we allow the same if we have these administrative approvals. And I think the one last thing I would add in here that I didn't put in the slides, but I believe it's in the paper, is there's always going to be a balancing act for us when we're making information public that includes, you know, if it's not been published in literature, if there isn't a, you know, study that's been published in a scientific journal, you know, we might get very specific data from an applicant based on, you know, what their fleet's doing and what the, you know, the duty cycles are. So there's a balance, I think, when we're presenting that information for a public comment period that we want you to consider about how much data do we make public so that people who are looking at this data in the public comment period can provide real comments, right? You know, if we aggregate everything, if we, you know, redact things because they're considered to be trade secrets, you know, a trade secret of the company, then, you know, that doesn't provide as fulsome an opportunity for public comment. So we're trying, we would like some comments from you, you know, on how we strike that balance between protecting the trade secrets of the companies that want to add new ERs, and making sure that, you know, we have a good, robust public comment process for this kind of administrative process. I'll pause there if anyone wants to raise their hand on that point or any additional comments. Otherwise, we'll move into our break.
I don't see any hands, though.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to move us into our break. I think we're going to take a 5-minute break. So we'll try and be back. Well, let's make it a little bit longer. So we'll try and aim to be back at 10:40 if that works for everybody. Yeah. Okay. And I'll update the slide very quickly. All right. Thank you. We'll be back in a little bit less than 10 minutes. Okay. Hi, everybody. It's 10:40, and I'm going to have us keep moving, just given the amount of material we have left to cover in this meeting. The next topic is lowering the carbon intensity of electricity as transportation fuel. So just to really briefly summarize what we do now, we do post this in the methodology document at that link on these slides. You can also find it on the Clean Fuels Program's main page. So actually, quick note, we have DQ's web team just did some major updates to that website and also reorganized the pages that are part of the Office of Greenhouse Gas. So your current bookmarks for the Clean Fuels Program website may be broken. If you go to that, to the old site, there is a link to the new site. We apologize for any confusion. It is still on our website. And the methodology that I'm discussing here for the electricity carbon intensities is under the guidance documents section of the main page for Clean Fuels Program. So what we currently do, based on the rulemaking in 2017 where we discussed electricity topics, is calculate both the statewide mix for Oregon's electricity along with utility-specific mixes on a five-year rolling average basis. We take data that is reported by the utilities to DEQ's greenhouse gas reporting program. We also use grid mix data from that program to determine what the emissions rate of Oregon's electricity was, and then what the resource mix is then used to determine the upstream emissions associated with other fuels that are being used in the mix, such as emissions associated with coal mining that, and transportation is being used in coal generators that serve Oregon. Currently, our rules only allow zero carbon electricity that is from a renewable source such as solar or wind that is behind the same meter or directly connected to the electric vehicle charger. So it is a relatively limited provision. We also have some requirements there that if the renewable generator either is not registered to generate renewable electricity credits, or if they do generate renewable electricity credits, that an equal number of those are retired to the charging claim to zero carbon in the clean fuel program. So the first topic I'm going to cover is how we set the statewide utility mixes. One of the considerations we have for this rulemaking is what to do as we increasingly see retirements of coal-fired power plants in Oregon at the end of this year and then across the Western grid over the next few years. As legislation that the Oregon legislature and agreements that the state government has put in place, require the phase out of coal from our electricity mix over time, and also in tandem require the increases in the state renewable portfolio standard mean that we'll be getting a greater share of our electricity from zero carbon resources. So the five-year average was, when we discussed this in 2017, the overriding factor that led us that we heard from stakeholders and that led us to this five-year rolling average was because of the variability of the hydropower system in the water years in the Pacific Northwest. There are drier years, there are wetter years, and it was believed that that would really cause some variability over time in the carbon intensity of our electricity. In practice, as you can see on this slide here, doesn't include any of the upstream emissions that I talked about a moment ago, but it's just like the direct emissions rate for the statewide mix. There is some variability year to year, but there isn't that much variability year to year. And in practice, the five-year rolling average that we have in place, I'm not sure if you can see this or not, but for the few years we've had this in place, basically raises the carbon intensity of the statewide grid mix a little bit. So, as we're considering how to adjust the statewide mix, as we've heard from stakeholders, that adjustments to the statewide mix should be made to account for these retirements. Because the other thing, so if Boardman retires this year, that's the in-state coal plant, for those of you who aren't familiar with their electricity sector. If we have a five-year rolling average, then, we will not have the emissions associated with Boardman come out of the grid mix, so we use the Clean Fuels program fully until basically 5 to 6 years after retirement. The one other point I shall, I'll just make very quickly here is that data to the greenhouse gas reporting program comes in the next year. So in practice, our 5-year rolling average is set, we set it in November and December of each year for the next year. And at that point in time, we have data from 2 years ago and then in the past. So the 2020 mix was set based on 2018 back to 2014 data. So, you know, there is some lag in, you know, when we, get the data and then, you know, with this rolling average, you know, when facilities will come out of that. So as we're considering what adjustments we could make to the statewide mix and to utility system mixes, we're considering two approaches. And what we heard from stakeholders as we were having some meetings prior to starting this rulemaking was either shortening the averaging time of the, how we set the mix. California's LCFS, for example, just uses a 1-year average. Or retaining that 5-year averaging period, but removing the emissions and energy related to fossil fuel fired power plants upon their retirement. So in considering this provision, we have a number of questions and considerations that we're trying to go through. You know, if we go to the, on that first option where we just, move to a single year average, is that accurate? I mean, the variability has not been that great over, the time frame that I showed you on the slide. Is there a good reason to expect that it will be much more variable over the next few years? If we do go to just, using single year. And then for that second option, some of the considerations we have and, raise your hand now because we'll stop and take comments in just a moment. Do we just remove the energy and emissions associated with, if we went with that option where we just take out that plant from the mix, should we, not replace the energy that it served with another emissions rate? Should we just take out both energy and emissions and, leave it as the remainder of the grid mix of serving Oregon at that time period? If we do replace it, what emissions rate would we use to replace that generation? Do we think at this much ahead of time, can we be reasonably certain what the carbon intensity is of whatever mix of generators is backfilling the energy demand for those power plants? Also, the other consideration we have with the statewide mix as we laid out, in the paper is that in our 2017 rulemaking, we had a discussion around, okay, we're creating statewide mix, and in that rulemaking, we also allowed for utilities to claim utility-specific mixes. A discussion that came up during our rulemaking back then was, should we adjust the statewide mix when we get utilities coming in to claim utility-specific mixes? Because, if I'll pick on Jason here, but if EWEB gets a mix, they have energy associated with that. Shouldn't we adjust the statewide mix to take out EWEB's energy emissions? At the time, we weren't sure how successful the utility-specific mix provision would be. So we said that we were going to take that comment, we'll monitor, as we do with all of our rules, how the rules work out in practice, and then come back in future rulemaking, because, the Clean Fuels program, as those of you who follow us know, we have a lot of rulemaking. We tend to have, good chances for another bite of the apple if we, think something hasn't worked out in practice or if we need to make adjustments. So the question we're raising for stakeholders here is, because utility-specific carbon intensity scores, the load associated with those utilities is just over 25% of all of the electric power served in Oregon, as reported to our greenhouse gas reporting program, should we begin to adjust the statewide mix to remove the emissions and energy associated with those utility-specific mixes? Okay, and I'll pause here for people to raise their hands, and I'll take a look and see if there's any comments in the chat box. So the first one is, if the purpose of the Clean Fuels program is carbon reduction, it makes no sense to exclude hydro, from Jennifer Jolly. So what we're doing with these is not that we exclude hydro, but that we are just accounting for the variability of the hydro system. And that was recently to the 5-year average. Hydro is included in the emissions and energy reporting to our greenhouse gas reporting program, and it is, you know, included. The second question here from Jason Huser is, does the change from EWEB, does the change for single year only apply to the statewide mix? So Jason, I think that's a question we would put out. I think it makes sense just, you know, for to parallel the provisions for the utility specific mixes and the statewide mix. I think in practice, the variability for the BPA for requirements customers and that mix is basically that same very minor variability that we're seeing in the statewide mix. So I don't think it would have a significant change to your carbon intensity score or the carbon intensity scores of the utility specific CIs. And actually, I see Jason's raising his hand now, so I'll unmute you and you can respond to me as you'd like.
Yeah, Bill, I didn't think I was going to raise my hand on this one, but you kind of called on me, so. Yeah.
Well, you put your request in the chat, so.
Yeah. Well, first off, I guess I'm sort of torn on this one. I can understand the implications of the lag time in adjusting for the retirement of a Boardman with a 5-year average. I guess I wouldn't be so quick to say that the change wouldn't have implications for entities that rely on hydropower if there's a really bad hydro year. That's what we like about rolling averages is the smoothing effect for the predictability of credit generation and programs that may depend on the monetization of credit. So I'm sort of torn on this one. We will get back to you with more explicit written comments when I can talk to my internal, you know, kind of EWEB team on this one. I will just, on the other matter, so I guess please take that into account. Some of the CI mixes may be that are heavily reliant on hydropower. This could be an issue. For the statewide mix, I probably agree that, yeah, from year to year, the statewide mix doesn't vary that much. And I can see the Boardman issue there. So I did want to say, I think it's fair to say you, in the, one of the slides, I think you talked about generally followed carbon accounting principles. That's probably correct that those principles would say if you're going to have a specific entity claim a specific carbon intensity that's much cleaner than the statewide mix, probably the general principles would say you would disaggregate that from the statewide mix. But I can't tell you, that's not my core competency, but that's what I do know about general carbon accounting principles. That would be what you would probably do.
Thank you. I think one quick point, and I think we got into this in the paper a little bit and discussed this, but I just want to make it explicitly here. So part of the complication about thinking about the electricity CIs in our program is you have to also think about them in terms of the EER adjustment for electric vehicles. So, for example, going from the statewide mix to a zero carbon intensity score only really boosts credit generation by about 30% because the electric vehicles are so much more efficient that when you adjust for that, the effective carbon intensity of electricity in electric vehicles is like around 30 grams. So the year-to-year variability will have effects on credit generation, but they're not like, you know, if you went from, I think EWEB's carbon intensity score is around 5, if you went from 5 to 10, it wouldn't like cut in half the number of credits you get. It would really just like be like a 1-3% difference. And I'm doing it off the top of my head, so I don't take that as written, you know, use the obligation estimator we have on our website to do those calculations. Stephanie, you want to call on whoever's next?
Yeah, the next person is Greg Alderson.
Hey, Greg from PG. Couple thoughts here. One, you know, if the desire is just to remove Boardman, then I think you can remove the emissions and the associated megawatts relatively easily
you know, since it's an intensity without having to make a bunch of assumptions about the replacement, that becomes more difficult, you know, as you go farther out and you have more plants you're trying to adjust that way, I suspect. So the you know, the shortening the average could make sense, but I think we want to see some rigor put to the analysis of the impact that could have on credit generation. Appreciate the work you've done so far, Bill. But I think it would make sense to look at some scenarios, you know, around consecutive bad hydro years, or, you know, just looking more specifically at bad hydro years than, you know, maybe are reflected in the 14 through 18 data that make up the 2020 CI. So something I think, you know, we're happy to help take a look at or talk more about, but I think before we, you know, go down the road to a 1 year or a, you know, less than 5 year, should apply some rigor around the hydro piece.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, as Corey mentioned earlier, we do want to get data from you guys. I think the electricity section is our second breakout in roughly a month. So if you guys have thoughts there, if you want to share what you think the impacts of multiple bad hydro years could be, you know, we're happy to take that in comment, or, you know, talk on the sidelines about what you think those effects could be so that we can do that analysis more fully.
Thank you.
Someone Eva just raised their hand.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just going to comment really quickly on removing the utility-specific CI scores, and just want to summarize this in the paper, but recognizing that that would reduce the total amount of credit generated by the utilities that use the statewide mix, and so kind of the opposite of the intention of the executive order. So.
No, I appreciate that comment. I think we would say that, you know, we're trying to view the overall effect of this rulemaking on credit generation. And if we, you know, as we were thinking through that option, that was partly why we were, and this is actually a good segue, looking at renewable electricity provision so that utilities or potentially others could match, you know, zero carbon attributes with, you know, electric vehicles, so there is more credit generation there, and that would account for that difference. But we, you know, acknowledge that effect in the paper, and I think that is an important consideration for us to keep in mind. And I see there are a couple of comments in the chat. I think, you know, we'll take a look at other data sources, like EPA's, and John had a, from MCAT, had a question on what the reason is for removing utility-specific load. I think some of the back and forth I have with Jason hopefully covered this. But it's basically just that generally if you subdivide a general mix and with more specific ones and you allow people to make claims in those more specific categories, that you should remove them from that general, you know, broader average. And that's what we were thinking there. That's something that was raised to us back during that 2017 rulemaking. So with that, I'm going to move on to the next slide just in the interest of time. So to start off, we've laid this out in the paper, but I just want to reiterate here. Our goal with the provisions around renewable electricity and marrying those up with the electric vehicle charging is to provide a clear incentive for more renewable electricity generation. As the number of electric vehicles in Oregon grows, we believe that the additional demand imposed upon the grid by those electric vehicles can and should be met with electricity that is being supplied by zero carbon resources. You know, we think that this makes sense in the context of our overall climate goals as laid out in statute and executive order from Governor Brown. And, you know, it makes sense in terms of our, you know, more narrow and specific mandate under the Clean Fuels Program to clean up the energy that we use for transportation as Oregonians. You know, we believe that a range of options will help send that signal, but that the qualifications that we put in place for any renewable energy being claimed under this program should be carefully defined to maintain the integrity of the program. Now, this was a topic that we talked about in our 2017 rulemaking. We heard a lot of back and forth at that time over this, and, you know, we're trying to be careful and consider it, and as we think through, you know, what the addition of these provisions could mean if we move forward with them. So just to quickly summarize what occurs in California, in their 2018 rulemaking, they added provisions to allow for incremental credit generation from renewable electricity that's being married up with electric residential charging of electric vehicles. They put in several conditions that define what renewable electricity qualifies, including that it, you know, has, there are certain categories there, and also that it meets the deliverability requirements of the portfolio content category one of the California RPS, which this is a gross generalization, but yeah, you know, just basically means that it is being generated in California, where it's being delivered or can be delivered into the one of the grids that make up California's electricity system. There are people who know those provisions far better than me on the call. I am trying to just very briefly cover them. I'm sure I got something wrong in that statement. Under their rule provisions, they allow for utilities, automakers, and others to claim that they are delivering renewable power through rapid ordering tariffs to electric vehicles in California. And this also harkens back to comments made earlier. So for the incremental credits, they require that folks show, you know, how much EVs were being charged and be able to demonstrate that they know where those EVs were being charged so that they can exclude charging that occurred at registered public chargers. You know, in practice, this means that those entities, you know, so if it's utility, they have a, you know, the car is on some sort of, you know, separate meter or smart meter that lets them know, okay, this is the car charging. You know, if it's an automaker claiming that, then they're using vehicle telematics to know, you know, this car charged this amount at this location. And based on that location information that they have, you know, it's not within, I believe, the requirements 200 feet of a registered public charger and or workplace charger in California under their LCFS. For their green tariffs, they allow load-serving entities, which down there means both utilities and community choice aggregators, to petition the Air Resources Board to recognize that the green tariff program they have meets the requirements for, you know, what they define as renewable electricity in the LCFS rules. And then once those tariffs are approved, they can be, you know, used by others, like, you know, so if there is a workplace that participates in that green tariff program, they have electric car chargers that are registered in the LCFS, then that workplace can say its chargers are being charged using zero carbon electricity through that green tariff. So I'm gonna present our initial thinking and some initial thoughts that we had as we look at this provision. Using the list of qualifying generation in the Oregon RPS as a starting point, you know, we think that it makes sense to potentially break renewable electricity into two basic paths in the program. One set of electricity that we just say, okay, this is renewable electricity, and it has, you know, no ongoing carbon emissions associated with it, so a solar panel, right, that, you know, doesn't, you know, is just sitting on a roof or in a field, and, you know, doesn't have any ongoing, you know, fossil energy or other things that would create a life cycle carbon impact for the electricity generation from that generator. And just say those categorically get to claim zero carbon in our program. The second path that we were thinking about is what we do with biomass and biogas. So under our current rules, you know, we don't really have biomass being used that much in the program, but for biogas, you know, all that comes in and goes through an application process where we can calculate its life cycle carbon intensity. Our belief here is that if we, you know, allow these sources of renewable power, so, you know, biomass going through a generator, biogas going, you know, also through a generator, that we would make them go through a modified fuel pathway application process. You know, we would use the existing or a modified version of our existing simplified calculators for some of the biogas sources or the full GREET or GREET model, and just adjust that to reflect the carbon intensity of electricity and still require that they go through a normal life cycle analysis process like all the other fuels that we have in the program. So, and I'm going to go through a bunch of stuff here and then stop for comments. So, you know, please, you know, make sure to put any clarifying questions in the chat box and then do some, raise your hand if you have questions, and we'll get to those when we stop. I just want to make sure we get through the section. So as stated previously, our goal with these provisions is to incentivize additional renewable energy deployments. In order to achieve that goal, in addition to just, you know, what counts as renewable electricity on the generator side, we're considering what parameters could be put into the program, such as temporal, like what vintages of RECs could count, when the generator went in service, or geographic restrictions that help make sure that we are creating some additional demand for renewable electricity. And we're making sure that, you know, in whatever way we can, we create that additional demand and create a signal for folks to go out and install more renewable electricity generators that can serve Oregon. This would be in addition to just a baseline requirement that the renewable electricity being claimed in the Clean Fuels Program is in addition to any other legal requirement or program. So, you know, the RECs being retired on behalf of charging in the Clean Fuels Program are not also being retired for renewable portfolio standards. One quick carve-out here that we heard as we were talking to stakeholders in the last week was we wanted to be clarify a point that was in the paper. So we mentioned that in addition to any other requirement or program, in this case, if we allow and go forward with the provision that allows green tariffs, that doesn't mean you have to retire additional RECs on behalf of the electric charging under that green tariff. With those, we're not including the RECs associated with that green power program, and that was part of the requirement, our initial thinking on this provision. For those of you that are less familiar with the electricity sector, I just wanted to put this up there. You know, as we're thinking about, you know, how electricity actually moves around in the West, you know, generally one of the ways we can think about it is the balancing authority. So these are areas where the grid is controlled by an entity, and they, you know, make sure to balance demand and supply of electricity across those areas. Oregon has four different balancing authorities that are in all or part of the state. That includes, CivicCorps and PacWest here. PGE has territory around Portland and also bits of Southwest Washington. BPA's transmission system covers the majority of the geography of the state, and then Idaho Power also has a very small slice of the far eastern part of the state. So, and I'm just putting that map up there so people can see it. This is also a map of the Western interconnection based on the Western Electricity Coordinating Council. So this is, you know, the way that the grid is structured in the western half of the U.S. There are some other interconnections on the, you know, east of the space, at least for the U.S. But I'm bringing that up and just putting that as some groundwork as we present this slide. So this is intended to summarize and also expand a little bit on what we meant in the paper. You know, we're looking at a number of different parameters here that we're considering and want to get feedback on. You know, we might go with all or none of these, and we're just kind of laying this out as an initial starting point to get feedback from you. So, you know, we have, we tried to rank these as we were coming up the slide in terms of, like, you know, a broader allowance of, you know, what RECs counts or renewable energy counts versus narrower. And we might not have categorized that correctly in all cases. You know, certainly if we create our own requirements, it could be broader than the Oregon RPS, or, you know, if we went with a voluntary standard like Green E, their certification process. So the purpose here is to lay it out. So first off, like, as we consider what electricity qualifies in the first place, you know, we can follow the standards in the Oregon RPS sets. We could designate Green E, which does a voluntary renewable electricity program, has its own standards, and just say that if the renewable electricity meets Green E standards, then it, you know, will work for us, and just tear off of that framework. Or we could look at another one. Or we could just very specifically put in our rules, you know, it must meet these requirements, and then have it be on us when, you know, folks are saying, okay, we've retired these RECs, to go through and confirm that they meet the requirements we put in the rule in terms of what sources of renewable electricity qualify. Separately, on the next category over is what time span counts. This is also the temporal restriction we're referring to, or might be referred to as vintage years. So RECs, are associated with electricity that's generated in a certain time frame. So what we're considering here is, setting a range of, which RECs can be retired on behalf of what electric vehicle charging. So, in the broadest version of this, I believe Green E allows for RECs who retired, that are 14 or 15 years old against current electric usage. We could narrow that down to the two examples we've given. The more narrow categories here are, within 2 years of when the electric vehicle charging is occurring, or within 3 quarters when the electric vehicle charging is occurring. And the most narrow restriction there is more closely mirroring some provisions that we have in the liquid fuel side of the clean fuels program, where if you put a bunch of fuel into commingled storage, you either have to claim it's being used within that same quarter or in the next quarter. So that's what we're basing that on. But this is all just, straw proposal, and we're trying to get the feedback here on what makes sense. We think that having the renewable energy being generated closer to when it's actually being claimed and used in the program makes sense and creates more demand in the present for more renewable electricity generation. But, that's just our initial thinking. In terms of geographic eligibility and why I showed you that math in the last slide, we're considering, should we put some restrictions on what RECs can be allowed in terms of where they're generated based, similarly to how, I mentioned that California has those rules around deliverability. Do we allow everything in the Western grids account? Do we say that it needs to be generated, in a balancing air authority area? So, one of those blobs on the previous map that also includes Oregon. Is there another path there? That's what we want to get comment on. And then finally, with the generator start dates, do we require that the RECs come from a generator that was put in place, from the start date of the Clean Fuels Program in 2016? Can they be older than that? That's all what we're thinking of in terms of, how can we, craft this provision so that it does create some additional demand for renewable electricity, and ideally that we're getting more solar panels being installed. In addition to, whatever projects we have in place, there are some examples now where folks are installing solar panels on site with electric vehicle chargers, and, we still want to make sure we encourage that in rules, because we do want to make sure we get more renewable energy deployment from these provisions. So with that, we're getting to one of our discussion slides. Just remind you now to go in the participants box and raise your hand if you want to comment on this, or to press *9 if you're on the phone. Stephanie, do you want to call on somebody? And then I'll also take a look at the chat box and determine if there are any comments or questions in there that we should answer in this part. I'll let you guys read the considerations on the slide since I've been talking for a bit.
All right. Thanks, Bill. The first person with their hand raised is Andrew.
Yes. Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. So I just wanted to comment, we are strongly supportive of incorporating the REC pathway. We think that California has set out a model for ensuring the environmental integrity of bringing RECs into this program, making sure that the reductions from them are additional beyond, renewable electricity that's retired for other purposes. I just wanted to ask a question to the DEQ staff about the time frame. In California, it's sort of like 3 quarters. I think it's in the quarter that the electricity was used, or 2 quarters previously, that you're able to use a REC to cover electricity dispensed during that time frame. I think in our experience in California, there's a very robust and well-developed market for RECs. And so we haven't had any problems with securing RECs. I just wanted to ask, I don't know too much about the Oregon REC market, and I just wanted to ask if you see any concerns about availability of RECs under certain time frames, if there's enough seasonal variation in generation of RECs that EV charging providers could potentially have difficulty securing RECs to cover their entire load dispensed, if there's a shorter time frame on their use.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, that's one I want to turn around and ask the people who are participating in this workshop with us, because I don't know the local REC markets as well as they do. And I think that's also just to harken back to that last slide, there's a balancing here, right? If we do very restrictive requirements, there'll be a very small pool of recs that can qualify for this. So there is some balancing that, you know, is core to our, you know, what we move forward with here around, like, you know, making sure there's enough recs to meet the demand for that electric vehicles are imposing while also keeping those standards pretty narrow. So that's a good question, Andrew, and one that I'd love to have somebody else comment on or respond to us in the comments, you know, what the effect of having more narrow restrictions would mean in terms of the pool here. Stephanie, do you want to go to the next question?
Yeah, the next person with their hand raised is Annabelle Drayton.
Thank you. And Bill, thank you for this presentation. I appreciate your comment that the qualification should be carefully defined. And I think the last table was very helpful for what you're considering. I think for RECs, there is the opportunity to create more demand for renewable electricity. I think there's also the concern that, a very broad allowance of RECs purchased, if a market participant could purchase unbundled RECs from anywhere in the country, then at any time, then that might not necessarily result in a meaningful carbon intensity reduction for Oregon. And so I think that needs to be really carefully monitored in the development of those rules if RECs are considered. I think there's also a concern that's been raised for me that if RECs are purchased, if bundled RECs are even purchased by certain utilities, it may, and then that electricity is then sold down into the California market. It's been expressed that that could result in double counting because the cap and trade system does not necessarily, if it's not considered an unspecified resource, the cap and trade system doesn't necessarily like identify that. So then you have some double counting there, and I think that's another provision that needs to be considered here.
Yeah, thank you. We'd appreciate comments on that issue, and you know we'll definitely keep that in mind as we look to further define this. Proposal. Stephanie, do you want to call the next person?
Yeah, it's Jana.
Hi, Jana from Oregon Environmental Council. I wanted to voice support for the proposal to do life cycle assessments for particularly biomass-based electricity. We have some miscible solid waste generators and others. And I think life cycle accounting is a really powerful part of the Clean Fuels program, and to have consistency between liquid fuels and other fuels, I think, is important there. So appreciate that consideration.
Yeah, thank you. Stephanie, you want to go to the next question?
Yeah, Jason Huser.
Yeah, hi, thank you. This is Jason Huser from the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I think our written comments will be much more extensive. But for now, I just wanted to raise the notion that for as far as what electricity qualifies, we see no reason to limit eligibility for any non-carbon emitting electric source. And I think we would suggest any carbon-free electricity should qualify. EWEB was a supporter of the Oregon RPS. We were part of many advisory groups in 2006 and 2007. We supported that legislation, but it's worth pointing out, you know, the Renewable Portfolio Standard is not a direct carbon reduction policy. It's a procurement standard of sorts that definitely does have carbon reduction implications. But I say that because, you know, with the preamble today, one of the DEQ staffers reminded us that the Clean Fuels Program is technology neutral, and it does have direct carbon reduction goals. So I guess I'd like to suggest it's somewhat incongruous to limit non-carbon emitting electric sources from qualifying. And to put this in a real tangible way, so this is not just a hypothetical. EWEB is in the process of identifying new products that we want to offer our customers in the future to respond to consumer demand. You know, right now, like almost every utility in the state, we provide our system mix to utilities. Obviously, we have a voluntary customer green power program, but as most people know, you know, that's unbundled RECs. It's very different from, you know, the type of new bundled product like the green tariffs that are under consideration that most people believe is a more tangible way to reduce their personal carbon footprint. And EWEB is looking at a variety of products. We are going to most likely try to develop a 100% carbon-free product for customers, and it will be from a mixture of renewable energies, including hydropower. And I just want to point out, while incenting the development of new renewables is an important goal for the state of Oregon, hydropower brings a lot of important characteristics to the regional energy portfolio. And we have an aging hydropower system that's in need of reinvestment. So I would say in addition to new renewables, reinvestment in a hydropower system that's going to help us reach our clean energy goals this century is also a very worthwhile goal. And as far as documentation, you know, we understand there would need to be all sorts of documentation to demonstrate that qualifying electricity was carbon-free. And, you know, in addition to RECs, there are other ways to register generation and verify that, where a megawatt hour came from, that it was from a specified resource. And finally, I just wanted to share, as far as the additionality, you know, if EWEB is able to offer a 100% carbon-free product, I want to stress that product would eliminate, you know, market purchases for any customer that subscribes to that product. And, you know, for us, we don't have any carbon emitting resources in our portfolio. It's reducing market purchases, which include unspecified resources that can include fossil fuels. That's where our customers, that's why that product is a great interest to our customers. And I've talked for a while. I'll wrap it up. We'll follow up with additional written comments.
Yeah, those are good comments, and I appreciate seeing those written form as well. I think the one thing I'd ask you to consider, because this is something that I've been thinking about as we look at this, is that, you know, we include, so it is true, right, we're talking about, like, with the Oregon RPS, I'll give it, you know, large hydro, the existing legacy hydro generators are not included as qualifying renewable energy under that provision. You know, with the Clean Fuels Program, because we're using the carbon intensity reported in by utilities to the greenhouse gas reporting program, we do take into account that all the large hydro has, you know, no carbon emissions associated with it. So, you know, that benefit of, you know, having those non-emitting resources already shows up in the fact that, you know, your utility-specific mix is at 4 or 5 grams versus the statewide mix up at 107. So I think what we're, you know, the balance in, like, adding these provisions, right, is, you know, how do we incent some new stuff? And then also, you know, if we allow some of the older units to also come in, you know, does that mean we need to do even more adjustments to the statewide mix if we're having very specific claims on, you know, that electricity going to these EVs? So that is kind of the balance that we're trying to think about. And the carbon accounting here can get quite tricky. So we're also just trying to think about, you know, what makes sense and the context of this program where electricity is a key fuel for us, and clearly a key goal for the DEQ more broadly. You know, we have a zero emission vehicle mandate. You know, we have the EV rebate program. We're trying to support transportation electrification explicitly through this program, but, you know, that it is one part of a larger program in this context. And Stephanie, do you want to call the next person? And Jason, I appreciate your comments and would definitely like to talk offline if you want to go into more detail on some of these topics. Stephanie, I think you're on mute if you're talking.
sorry about that. Andrew is the next person up, and there's also a question from Michael in the chat.
Hey, this is Andrew Dick with Electrify America. Again, I just wanted to second the comments of Jason in terms of not limiting the types of electricity that can be used in the program.
biogas to electricity pathways, for instance, offer a really compelling opportunity for EV charging providers to maximize the environmental benefits that they get under the program. I also agree with the comments of Jana that, those non-zero, even potentially negative, they should be subject to a full life cycle accounting that properly reflects the environmental attributes. But once again, I did want to point to California. California for the electricity sources that it labels as zero, wind, solar, hydro, there is sort of a shortcut where you don't need to go through a full tier two application. Those fuels can come into the program and be assigned a zero score, which is a helpful shortcut just administratively for EV charging providers who are trying to get renewable electricity to their stations in an expeditious manner. So just wanted to add that comment and second the comments that came before. Thank you.
Thank you. So I still have a 13 slides to get through and roughly a half hour to do that in. So let's take one or two more comments here if there are any. And then it's going to keep us moving forward a little bit so we get through the entire presentation and have some opportunity for a more general public comment at the end.
John raised his hand, and then Mike.
Yes, this is John Borton, Clean Futures. So just in general, I'd encourage broader parameters, which play fewer restrictions, but can better incent the green electricity sources and also the EVs, and also want DC to make the requirements technology neutral with respect to other fuel sources in the program. Just for what had been a comment about concern with double counting, and I would imagine Oregon's rules would probably be similar to California's, where California uses a REC, a renewable energy certificate, which is created from the regional tracking system to ensure there's no double counting, and that REC is retired. So I would assume that Oregon would probably do something similar there, so that should alleviate that concern. However, going through that process to create and certify that REC, there is a time delay in there, so that should be considered in the temporal requirements, and that there is a time issue to create that REC before that's available to be used and then retired, so that should be incorporated in there as well.
Gotcha. And yes, I just very briefly, we would imagine if we allow RECs in the program that we would be using REGIS or another REC tracking system to ensure that there isn't double counting. Stephen, let's go to the next comment, and then I'll keep moving on the slides. And again, we'll have a written comment period. We'll have more specific breakouts. I just want to make sure that I don't want to cut off comment while we're still getting good comments, but we do have a balance just right here.
Yeah, the next person is Mike.
Yeah, I'll keep it pretty brief. This is Mike Getz from Oregon Cub. I just wanted to comment on specifically the REC piece, and I do think that there is a balance to be struck, between not being overly prescriptive and also making sure that, benefits from RECs or from other renewable electricity are actually kind of flowing into the program and providing benefits to Oregon and the region. And just wanted to give an anecdote about what we do for the IOU voluntary renewable energy programs. And so those are for Pacific Power and PGE, and kind of the balance that we've struck there to make sure that benefits are flowing into Oregon is that we only recognize RECs that are GreenE certified, and there's a preference given for Oregon-based RECs. All of those RECs have to kind of be within the Regis footprint, but that could be a good middle ground to be sure that, there's kind of quantifiable environmental attributes that are being, tracked or kind of recognized by this objective third party that's certifying them as GreenE, and then also kind of layer on top of that is that if it's a REC that's coming out of a project that's based in Oregon, that could be given a higher level priority. But I can do some more thinking and follow up with your comments as well.
Yeah, and I'd be interested to see how, if we do have some sort of preference requirement, how we could craft that within our program. I'd be interested in seeing comments on that. Okay, so with that, I'm going to move on to the next topic, which is, so we kind of laid this out at the beginning of the section, but just to go into it a little bit more, we're thinking about two pathways for claiming zero carbon electricity in the program through this renewable energy provision. One would be participation in a utility green tariff program, And the second would be retirement of renewable energy credits. And we're considering, so there are two buckets of electric vehicle charging the program. Buckets is the clicker way we refer to them. One is the charging at residences that, you know, we do have an estimation methodology for, and that goes to the utilities if they're opted in, or the backstop aggregator. And then that second bucket is stuff that is at public charging, workplaces, seats, multi-unit dwellings, where the charger owner or EVSE is keeping track of the amount of electricity and reporting that on a quarterly basis in the Clean Fuels program and generating credits directly. So we're considering how this provision would apply to both. We want to make sure that if we adopt provisions that there is some pathway for both sets of charging to be able to claim zero carbon electricity or negative carbon in the case of some of the potential biogas pathways that have negative carbon intensity scores, because they represent an additional reduction in methane. So for non-residential charging, as I'll start here, for meter charging that, you know, at one of these locations, you know, the other example I threw in there was like transit districts that are running electric buses or, you know, streetcar max. DEQ is that the current entities that are reporting that charging and generating credits should be allowed to make that zero carbon claim, either through the user utility green tariff or RECs, if we move forward with those provisions. You know, that's our initial thinking here is that if they're in a utility green tariff, we have some requirement on a regular basis that they prove to us that the charging equipment for is covered by that utility green tariff. So we're curious about what documentation requirements make sense here, and we'd like some feedback on that as we're moving through this rulemaking if we move forward with this provision. If we're allowing booking claims for RECs, like I mentioned a little bit briefly after John's comment, it would be, you know, showing retirement in most likely Regis, as that's the REC tracking system that covers the Western grid. But, you know, we have some sort of tracking system that, you know, makes sure that the RECs are generated and then retired on behalf of the Clean Fuels Program and the claims being made. And we would also, you know, and that retirement report is also how we would, and, you know, we're trying to think through how this would work, you know, marry up and make sure that we can ensure that the RECs are retired, meet any qualification requirements that we discussed in the last section. For residential charging, I think we're currently thinking about two paths forward. So the first path is basically maintaining the existing credit generators for residential electricity credits. And what we would do is for those utilities, you know, we, when we're doing the estimation of how much charging occurs in their service territory, letting them know, okay, you know, XYZ utility, your customers have this many EVs and we're estimating they charged 300 megawatt hours last year or in the last period. If you want to generate incremental credits, please show us, you know, 300 RECs that were required because each REC is associated with a megawatt hour of renewable generation. And then we would issue the credits based on the zero carbon intensity score versus statewide mix to that utility. If they have customers that are in a green tariff program already, we could potentially just say, okay, we'll go back and forth, make sure that, you know, the this is an area where we want comments, but, you know, we have, we get the address level data at DEQ for where these cars are registered based on DMV registration requirements. You know, if we could get similar address level data on the, you know, which customers are associated in with green tariffs, we could just say, okay, all that is under green tariff program already, so that should count as zero carbon, and then here's the remainder that you can retire RECs on if you'd like. The second path forward, you know, is more similar to the current California model, where we, you know, require some better data source because they have more direct knowledge of the charging. And that's where, you know, utilities, automakers, or others, you know, demonstrate to us that they know how much charging occurred in various areas, you know, and is occurring outside of public or other registered charging. And then if they provide that detailed information, we allow them to claim you know, the incremental credits based on retiring RECs against that generation. So, you know, in considering this provision, there are a number of issues that we want to consider. and this is one of those typos we'll probably fix before we post the slides. So for residential charging, should the utility have priority to generate the incremental credits? Will they? And I think the other thing to put on the table here, will the utilities actually take advantage of this provision? Because we want to make sure that if we adopt these rules, that they are used. So, when we go through this rulemaking, as we're taking these rules and getting them ready for an Environmental Quality Commission to consider, I always anticipate commissioners asking us, like, if we're doing this, will people actually use it? And I want to be able to tell them yes. So we want to know which of these paths do people think, will get the most uptake and, have more credits coming from EVs that can go back into supporting the transportation electrification goals that the governor's executive order charged us with supporting under Senate Bill 1044 from, I think, the 2019 legislature. So going back to the considerations here, and then we're going to open it up for comments, if we do have a hierarchy, what should that hierarchy look like? Who should be allowed to generate credits there? In terms of the non-residential charging, does our initial proposal here make sense? Is there somebody else where it might make sense to allow them to claim credits? Are there some other proxies we can use here? So I'll pause here, let people raise their hands. I'll also take a quick look at the chat and see if there's anything that we should respond to in there. If you have any comments here, please raise your hand now and Stephanie will call you.
Hi, it looks like we have a comment from Annabelle. I have a question that maybe the EQ staff knows, or folks who've been involved in California's program. If an automaker were to have priority over claiming those incremental credits, how would the value of those credits be used to benefit Oregon?
Yeah, so this goes back to that topic early on around setting requirements for what credit revenues go for. And this is actually also part of why we were considering that. It's both that the values are getting more significant and that also, if we adopt a provision like this one where automakers or another private entity is generating credits on behalf of that charging, some requirements that make sure that that revenue isn't just realized as profit for those shareholders, but instead is going back to our transportation electrification goals. So in California, the requirements that are in the paper, I believe, also apply to those automakers and third parties. So they need to show that the, revenues from credit sales associated with the incremental credits is going back into some form of promotion of transportation electrification in California. And if we move forward with that in this rulemaking, we would do something similar. So we make sure that, it goes, into some category of spending that we can be assured will help promote EVs in Oregon, either, cash on load rebates, targeted, dealer incentives, advertisements. Just throwing out some quick examples here because we do want to take comments on this. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
I
don't see any other raised hands. Jana, raise your hand.
Hey, I'm sorry because I can't go through the slides again. Just clarifying again that this can be for green tariff. So if utilities are using this, it would likely be, it could be on the basis of green tariff, or this is a REC only kind of option.
Yeah, so, and this is a question for the utilities as well. I don't think they could, my understanding of how the green tariff programs work is incomplete, so I'll let somebody else step in here if I'm wrong. But if the customer is deciding to sign up for the green tariff, so it's a customer decision about if they're paying for the green tariff. I don't think there would be a mechanism for the utilities to enroll customers that have EVs in the green tariff. So if there is something like that, please correct me. So I think that if we applied it for residential charging, there could be a hybrid framework where the customers that already are in a green tariff could the utilities could demonstrate that they're in a green tariff and, they don't need to retire additional RECs on top of that. But then for the customers not in a green tariff, they could retire RECs on behalf of those customers that didn't enroll in the green tariff when the folks knocked on their door, or however they found out about.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to take one last comment and then keep moving just because we have 20 minutes before we told you guys to finish. So I think I saw Mike first. Sorry to Stephanie for taking your thing here, but Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, just really quick, I just wanted to recognize that, you know, the way that green tariff programs are currently structured, it's for individual customers to potentially be able to opt into them to change, you know, their electricity supply. But we are kind of moving towards a paradigm where we're thinking about green tariffs for municipalities. Places like Milwaukee, Portland, Multnomah County are kind of looking at, you know, their own individual renewable mandates. And I think if we kind of move towards a paradigm like that, it might be more administratively easy to kind of loop that into the clean fuels program rather than on like an individual customer basis. So just wanted to kind of recognize that distinction, and we might not be able to make that yet, but wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, and Mike, you participated in our previous rulemaking, so you know we'll have a future one, and if that becomes the case and we adopt these provisions, I'm sure we can adjust it going forward. Jan, do you want to quickly?
Yeah. Sorry, this is Jana from OEC. I forgot to add, I think consideration of the backstop aggregator being one of the potential entities able to claim incremental credits would be an interesting idea, just then to think about some of the investments, equity investments and other things that could happen in Oregon as well. So I'll just throw backstop aggregator into the mix.
Let me just ask to clarify that point slightly. Do you mean having the backstop aggregator be eligible to generate all the incremental credits and nobody else is allowed to for residential charging, or just that they can generate incremental credits like the other utilities for the cars that end up in their buckets, basically?
I think it's worth exploring both. I'm not sure I have a definitive answer at this time.
Well, I'm just raising that part for you and others to consider as you file comments on this issue. Because that's something we've thought about too. Okay, so with that, I'm going to move on to the next section so we can just get this meeting roughly on time and plus a couple minutes for more public comment. So as we laid out in the paper, DQ believes that the definition of, just very quickly for folks who aren't familiar with the Oregon way, the way that the Oregon program works versus California's. California's LCFS relies on general statutory authority, whereas the Clean Fuels program has very specific statutory authority and does a lot of defining of the basic parameters of the Clean Fuels program in our air quality statutes. So ORS, or Oregon Revised Statute 468A.25, defines a number of terms related to the Clean Fuels program, including the definition of what a credit is. We interpret this definition in our statute to mean that we cannot issue credits that are not tied to actual reductions of carbon as we lay out through the carbon accounting framework in the Clean Fuels program. So we've had some discussions with stakeholders, and we've had stakeholders raise the capacity credits or credit multiplier. Capacity credits are a concept in California. There are also mechanisms like the Part 3 agreements in the British Columbia Low Carbon Fuel Standard that are not directly tied to actual reductions of emissions, but instead are credits being issued to support future emissions reductions, by subsidizing, electric vehicle chargers, hydrogen stations, and the like. We do not believe we have the authority to do that, so we're going to focus in this section on the advancing credits concept that we raised in the white paper, where instead of issuing credits that are not tied to a real reduction of carbon, we are instead moving the crediting forward in order to help buy down the cost of electric vehicles and get more of those electric vehicles deployed soon. So the concept, as we lay it out in the paper, is that, somebody takes an action and we issue the first 2 years of credit, so we'd expect that infrastructure or electric vehicle to generate, issue to them up front when it, hits the road, goes in service, so that can help buy down the purchase price of that equipment. They would not generate credits until they pay back to the system the number of credits we gave them up front. So if I, I'll go into this in the example on the next slide, but, just there'll be a payback period. They won't generate credits during that payback period. And then after they pay back the system, so we get the emissions reductions that were credited up front, we allow them to just generate credits normally going forward. So we're going to give a quick example here with a transit bus. You know, as we lay out in the slides or in the discussion paper, we think this is, you know, a pretty easy avenue, or one that would make sense for this provision. But, you know, if we estimate that a transit bus running on a fixed route is going to generate 100 credits a year, and that the transit agency will be the credit generator for those, for that bus, then, you know, there's an application process, and we lay this out in a lot more detail in the discussion paper, but, you know, we go through an application process, we agree on the number of credits it's going to generate each year, and then when the transit agency gets the bus and it's put in service, we give them that, you know, in this example, 5 years of credit generation or 500 credits up front. Then as the bus goes throughout its normal operation, the transit agency keeps reporting to DEQ the charging. We in the transit agency keep track of how many credits it should have generated each year. And if it hits those 500 credits in year five, we start them crediting again. If they end up running that bus in a different way, or we were really conservative with our estimates, and, you know, they generate 500 credits from that bus in 3 years, then at that point they start generating credits again, normally like any other piece of electric vehicle on the road. We're also looking at some other requirements in the paper and refer you back to that. And in this example where, you know, they promise to keep the bus in state or pay back the system if they do, you know, sell the bus off after the first few years before the credits are paid back to the system so that we can maintain the environmental integrity of the overall clean fuel system. So some questions we have generally on this concept, I'm going to go through, lay out a couple of questions and then stop us for discussion on this topic. You know, if we do allow for advancing of credits, should we place a limit on the total amount of credits we advance in any given year? You know, what requirements do we want to put on the recipient? You know, we have equity principles that the governor laid out in her executive order and that DEQ generally as an agency just tries to meet. And are there ways that we could incorporate those into this kind of provision so that we can target additional, you know, heavy duty electrification in areas where we know it's going to displace diesel and it's going through communities that are already affected by, you know, elevated air toxics levels or something like that. Are there ways that we can identify those communities, identify those vehicles and have this provision targeted to them? Other considerations. So as we apply this concept to fleets, should we keep it limited to public fleets or to private fleets where this could make sense and we could, you know, have a, you know, binding agreement with the private owner. You know, do we know for those private fleets that the vehicles will actually remain in Oregon? You know, maybe this means like identifying specific types of fleets. But, you know, the plus side of, you know, TriMet or Lane Transit is that their buses run in Oregon, and we know that those are Oregon Transit districts. So we know the vehicles will be used here, and they also have a very defined place where they're going to be charging. So, and the other just broad consideration here, do we want to limit this to like heavy duty vehicles that will likely be replaced on diesel? Does it make sense to apply to light duty vehicles? Are there specific applications where we think that this additional boost is needed? And we're, you know, we'd like comments on that. As we apply this concept to infrastructure, and this is a side we'll stop and take discussions on this point. So we're considering if this concept could be successfully applied to public charging infrastructure. You know, does it make sense for the private entities that are putting out these stations or public entities putting out these stations to get these credits up front versus getting them over time? Will they actually take advantage of this provision? You know, how reliable could that forecast be for, you know, a public charging station where they build it? And, you know, they're assuming that people will come. You know, should we limit it to certain types of electric vehicle infrastructure, such as high voltage public chargers, or like limit it to multi-unit dwellings if we allow it outside of public charging? So I'll stop here and take any clarifying questions or discussion on the advanced crediting option, and then we'll move to our public comment period. Stephanie, do you want to call in folks as you see hands raised?
I will do that. Mark has their hand raised.
And Mark, you're muted right now. I'm going to unmute you. So let's see if I can get that to work. Okay,
should be okay. Okay, can
you? Yeah, I can.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. So just two points. One observation comment is, so this notion here of advanced crediting is actually quite different from what the Air Resources Board in California has implemented in their last regulation, where the advanced credits are only offered in the event that there are enough credits for obligated party to comply. So just an observation, you know, I'm not saying we have to follow CARB, but this is quite different.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second point I would like to make is that normally, my understanding is the electricity supplier is the credit generator, not the electric cars or not the fleets of vehicles. So I'm not sure if it's actually a little bit different already today in the CFP or if you're proposing something different. But just my understanding is the fuel supplying equipment, you know, typically the charging stations or the utilities, electric utilities, are the CFP credit generators, you know, not electric cars, not electric fleets. So just kind of a question, observation here.
Yeah, and those are both good points. And yes, this is a very different application of that advancing concept as the one that's in the current California rules. Just very quickly, we do for electric transit fleets allow them to be the transit and basically the buses. It's the operator that is allowed to claim credit who designates somebody else as an aggregator in our rules. Generally, it is true that it's the fuel supply equipment that is the generator of credits. And as we applied this, if we go forward with this concept and we allow private fleets to do it, I think we would need to think through how that works with the credit generation. Who is allowed to generate credits in the rules, and if we would need to adjust that in order to capture, you know, this advancing concept. But thank you for your comments, and Stephanie, can you call the next person, please?
Yeah, Annabelle. Thank you. I think the advancing credits considerations that you all put forward are really helpful, and I think it could be a really beneficial mechanism to provide some of that. The coverage in the upfront incremental cost, especially for some of the more expensive equipment like medium and heavy duty or fast charging to supply some of the power to medium and heavy duty vehicles. I think you've outlined a lot of really good considerations. I think for eligibility, it would be important that the market participant is acting in the public interest and, providing community benefit. And I think public entities definitely need that. I want to make sure that tribes and tribal like transit agencies are considered in there. I don't know if there needs to be specific language in the rules to allow for that. I also think that, I think it's because of the scope of this rulemaking, it's implied, but I think it would be really important to make sure that the eligible fuels really have a pathway to zero emissions. And so we would really want to make sure that those are the fuels that were able to benefit from this advancing credits model. And then I also think one thing that could be considered is, especially for transit or other entities who benefit from this, how to prioritize some of the use of those vehicles in, the most impacted or frontline communities. So, in California, there's virus screening that's used. In Washington, there's the Environmental Health Disparities Map. And I think finding a way to target some of those actual air quality benefits to frontline communities would be really beneficial. The only last question I have is there a point at which too many credits would flood the market? And I don't know if that's possible, but I'd be curious.
Yeah, I think those are good considerations for us to keep in mind. And I think that, we do rely on our colleagues here at DCUNOHA to help us identify areas where we think there are frontline communities that are overly burdened by air pollution, especially because of the transportation program. We try to keep an eye on, where those communities are in relation to transportation air pollution. And also, I think this is Corey mentioned earlier that we'll be doing a study to help us figure out, where the Clean Fuels program is cleaning up the air. And I think part of that will help us identify, specific areas of the state where we think that there is a higher burden on the people breathing in those areas. In terms of your question, which I'm hoping I fully remember after that answer, actually, can you ask it again? I'm sorry. I don't want to make sure I get the answer right. I apologize.
I was wondering if there were, if you, for some reason, everyone was taking advantage of the advanced credits and there was a significant amount of credits that were to flood the market, would that, is that a possibility under the amount of credits we could anticipate?
Theoretically, yes. I think that, as we look at provisions and as we look at additional credit generation, both in this rulemaking or future rulemaking, we have our own estimates of how many credits will be needed for compliance. I think that is part of that consideration on if there should be an overall limit on the number of credits we advance in any given year. I think that to a certain extent, because we're shifting in time these credits, right? Is credit generation would occur over 5 years, is occurring in 1 year, or is occurring over 3 years, is occurring in 1 year, depending on how we craft this concept if we move forward with it. I think that's less of a concern because, we're getting more credits today and less credits tomorrow. That said, it depends on how broadly we write this provision, how many entities take, actually participate in it. And the overall slice of credit generation that's coming from electricity versus other fuels. And right now, electricity is still a relatively small fraction of the credit generating clean fuels program, one that we expect will grow significantly over time as the ZEV mandate and other things require more electric vehicles in the state. So with that, and probably for the close time, actually, I should have stopped myself sooner so we can get to the next comment. Stephanie, can you call the next question, please?
Yeah, great.
Yeah, Greg from PG. I was just going to say, I think that there's a lot of opportunity with the advanced crediting. I think the public side is valuable. I think we should poke at the private and see what limitation or, how many makes sense, but that there certainly should be opportunity for private fleet. So I appreciate the agency's work to look at this and, around the private fleet, maybe there's some kind of a, mechanism or buffer pool to address some of the questions folks have had around, the credits and, what happens with a private fleet as opposed to, a more sticky long-term public one. So appreciate the potential and future work.
All right. Thank you. Stephanie Collins.
Michael?
Michael Graham with Columbia Atlantic Clean Cities Coalition. I think this is a really beneficial mechanism to include, especially in the absence of any state effort to find some more real funding dollars to put forward for transportation electrification. I would say that there's probably quite a few pieces here that need to be workshopped to ensure the integrity of the Clean Fuels program as a whole, as well as, streamlining the application process, creating some ways for, any kind of issues like, for instance, a pandemic to, lessen the impact on not having credit generation over a period of time, that sort of thing. So I'd love to talk more about how we can improve this concept and, provide some meaningful dollars to help buy down the incremental cost of, electric vehicles and equipment and traditionally fueled vehicles and equipment.
Yeah, thank you. Please submit any written comments along that, and if you want to talk to us offline, we'd be happy to do so. We'll be talking about this again, I think, in the third of the breakout meetings. So whatever workshop we need to between now and then, we're happy to, one-on-one, and then take it back to the group for more broad discussion.
The next person was John.
Yes, this is John Thornton, Clean Future. I would just like to say to maybe be careful with putting too many restrictions on location-based incentives to benefit disadvantaged communities, and don't take that the wrong way. I'm not saying they don't deserve it, but I've done a lot of work in California, and we've seen unintended consequences of tying to, for instance, Cal Enviro screen metrics, and we've literally had excellent zero-emission projects that have been located on the wrong side of the road for where the census tract is, and that's been a barrier for getting funding. So I just say just kind of be careful or mindful of that.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you.
And then Greg. Greg Alderson?
Oh. I'm sorry. I forgot to lower my hand. No comment.
Sorry about that, Greg. I don't see any other raised hands. There are some comments in the chat if you have time for them.
Yeah, I think actually just given that we're basically at 12, I want to move to our public comment period and have folks, you know, as with all DC rulemakings, we have a rulemaking advisory committee, but we also want to get as broad input as we can, either in this opportunity or through written comments. So if you have any general comments, if you have specific comments on one of the provisions before, please raise your hand now and we'll take them. And then while we're while you guys are getting those comments up, I'm also going to go to the next slide, which includes the email address for this rulemaking. You know, that will, so folks can see what that is and where to send comments while we're waiting for any general comments to commenters to raise their hands.
Yeah, I'll just, this is Corey, so I'll just say that I really do appreciate all the comments there. I thought it was a really good conversation. I've been monitoring the chat. I think we got to many, many of the questions. We have recorded, copied all of those questions in the chat, and we'll be following up with those that didn't get directly responded to today. But I do believe that we've included all of that. So I'll a quick call for additional questions, but I really want to get to this next set of slides and let you all go as well. Anything else?
I'm not seeing any hands raised. Why don't we let you go through this next slide, and if anyone does have a public comment, just raise your hand now or press star 9 if you're on the phone, and we'll get to those after Corey summarizes the next step slide.
Yep. Okay. So that sounds good, Bill. So the next step slide. So covered at the beginning of the meeting, these meetings, the next meetings are very tight. I'm going to do the one thing that I always hate that when people do for me, when they don't give specific deadlines for things. But I think you can tell by the way that the nature of these discussions going and the cadence for these next breakout meetings, they're going pretty fast. We are already working on the papers for the next three breakout meetings. The general concept is that we're going to kind of build out this information, take the input, and dive to that one next level of detail to have very detailed targeted discussions in the breakout. Generally speaking, I'm not going to say you're going to have a deadline a week from today for the comments, but what I'm going to do is say that generally for the meetings, especially the second and the third breakouts that I comment, that we get at least 2 weeks prior to that will be most helpful as we develop those papers, because we target to have the discussion papers out a week prior to the meeting. Does that make sense? For the October 8th meeting, obviously, that is 2 weeks from now, which means that we're trying to get that paper out for discussion next week, Thursday. So if you have specific comments for that, one, get them to us as soon as possible. Two, at a minimum, let us know that you plan to submit them so we know that we're waiting for them. If it makes more sense to call and set up a call between now and then, we are open to that as well. All of this material is on the CFP website. Like Bill said, we have a brand new website that got launched yesterday, so you will have to reset your bookmark, and it is also there will be a link to the rulemaking page as well, and so between those two places you should be able to find the slide set that we'll be posting, as well as the audio for this, and also the email address on here is the email address that we use for the rulemaking. I know many of you are used to kind of emailing us directly, but really helpful to have all the comments go to the CFPE 2021 mailbox so that we can make sure that everything gets managed properly. I don't see any other additional hands raised. One last call for questions. No? Okay. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. This is a very good conversation, and we've got a lot to follow up on. So keep all those comments coming in, and let us know where your thoughts are. Okay? Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you.